I'm Paul Childers, and I represent the restaurants in Southwest.
So Pat Shaw, I'm a public health nurse and a program manager at Clark County Public Health.
Mark Collier, representing subject designers and sellers and operation maintenance specialists.
I'm Rhonda Turner, I'm a council and a surgery director at Legacy Santa Cruz.
Sandy Atkinson, I work as the director of the Prevention and Youth Services Program at ESD 112, and I'm in this role as an education representative.
And I'm Julie Grimm, and I'm an assistant at Clark County Public Health.
And I'm Don Stewart, I'm the communications manager at Clark County Public Health.
There's one down, chief operations officer, Clark County Public Health.
And I'm the investment director, I'm president of the Long Island Center.
I'm Bobby, and I'm the chief of Alabama Washington, and I represent the OC, which is all of the police station chairs.
And then John Stewart, the president.
Very welcome, a physical therapist with himself, and I'm with a super. She's got an MPH degree, but she's also a registered dietitian by background, and started as a program manager for the Women, Infants, and Children Nutritional Program, WIC program, back in 1998. And at that time, we were moving into a computerized system, and Tricia helped usher that along, took leadership in that. And at that point, we were serving over 15,000 people. But what was amazing about Tricia, a tribute to her mind, the way she thinks about things, is that early on she realized she was involved in a nutritional program with kids and moms, and early on she saw the connection between early childhood, maternal child health, and chronic disease later in life and chronic disease prevention. And she realized that interventions early on, including the health of moms and babies, have a lot to do with preventing a lot of things that we face later in life. So so subsequent to that, she led the development of the chronic disease prevention team here and P4HN, Partnership for Healthy Neighborhood Initiative. We got the CTG grant, the Community Transformation Grant, that's now ending. Tricia played a leading role in getting the Healthy Living Collaborative started. She's still on the Healthy Living Collaborative, but will be leaving. But that's going to go on. It's a wonderful community collaboration that, actually, I believe with all the CDG grants from the state, we're the only ones, outreach was the only one that had an ongoing healthy living collaborative or something like that, that will be sustainable. But I got a list of things that I jotted down. Just, this is not an all-inclusive list. Some things that she's done. She was involved in getting funding and educational opportunities for community gardens. She's really involved in that. And the Growing Groceries Mentor Program. She was involved in creating Steps to Healthier Clark County, the Clark County Food System Council. She's been taking a leadership role in a lot of health impact assessments and the bike and pedestrian plan related to food access, healthy food access, as well as opportunities for physical activity. She's on the steering committee of Sunday Streets Alive. She actually led us in developing healthy corner stores, healthy neighborhood restaurants, and getting food stamps into the farmers market programs. She supported the work of the Safe Kids Coalition, including the Car Seat Coalition, so she's involved in injury prevention as well. And she's been on the steering committee for the Children Can't Wait campaign to support early learning families. You'll know her, she's received lots of community awards. She was on the Healthy Living Collaborative Leisure team that was selected to this National Leadership Conference. And she's been on the leadership team. She's been Chief Operations Officer for the past year, and she's completely exceeded any expectations I had for what a Chief Operations Officer could do. I've been around a long time. I know a lot of public health officials, and Tricia is among the top that I've ever worked with, and she's doing a great job in Washington County. So wish her well, and just want to let you all know that she's leaving. I don't know if you want to say anything.
Well, I will say I said this at my. It's been a week of just say goodbye, which is kind of fun. I'm so tall and not really working this week. But I did say the other day at the Healthy Living Collaborative, the hardest thing is still these partnerships. This is such a partnership community. This is such a great community that works well together. And so it's hard to say goodbye to that, but I know that I'll find new opportunities and new friends doing great work. So that'll let me say goodbye to all of you and keep doing all the great work.
Okay, there's some changes in back leadership. So I don't know how many folks know, but Lori Lebowski, who has resigned as back chair, and she was appointed in back in 2011 by the board, and she's been chair since early 2013. I really want to thank her for her service, but she's resigned. But fortunately, Trevor Evers, am I pronouncing your last name right, or is it Evers?
Evers.
Evers.
Evers. Yeah, that's right. Close to
the West Coast. It's at East Coast. I know you as Trevor, has graciously agreed to step up as interim chair, and Mark Collier has graciously agreed to step up as interim vice chair. This will be pending selection of a nomination committee that you guys are going to do later this fall. And this will be at the October meeting. I think you're going to select a nomination committee. And then the nominations committee is to prepare a slate of officers with elections in January. So that's basically the plan. So I wanted to let everybody know about that. And we have a few departing members. One departing member in addition to Lori. And then I'm going to just mention the new members. Dr. Gill, our dentist, will be leaving back after 3 years. He's a periodontist here in Vancouver. So he was a great member of the back, but we're happy to announce that we have 3 new back members, including a dentist replacement. So one of the new members is here. So I think you met Tracy Rude, who's our new consumer representative back, and she works for the Evergreen School District at the Skills Center, where you teach applied medical sciences and nursing assistant certified. We did an orientation with Tracy, and I could be an incredible back member. She's already up to speed on stuff, so I'm glad you're able to come here. Bryce Hackett is our new youth representative. He's at Columbia River High School, where he's enrolled in international baccalaureate courses and dance courses at Clark College. And he wants to go to Rice University. It's a long-term goal in bioengineering with a minor in global health technologies. So he's already figured that out. And I think the reason he's not here now, Julie, correct me if I'm wrong, is he's already in Houston doing some consulting or something over there.
Rice had actually was interviewing with Rice.
He's interviewing.
Yeah.
He's got a pretty amazing resume already. And then this is exciting. Dr. Rendy Houston is going to be our new. I don't know how many of you guys knew this stuff. This is new. Okay. He's been a pediatric.
He was listed in a reflector yesterday.
Huh?
He was listed in a reflector.
Oh, I heard that. Oh. Well, he's been a pediatric dentist for 19 years. He lives in Santa Cruz. He's on the Washington Dental Service Foundation Board. And he was very instrumental, I believe, in getting the New Day Dental Clinic started. And he's on their board. And he's been involved in community, what I would call public health ministry, for many years. He's an incredible leader in the community. He won the community the Clark County Public Health Community Award in 2009, but he's really been very instrumental in the community getting access to oral health care for low-income children. So he's a pretty amazing guy, and he's a new member as well. So just to lead everything off here, just because there's some new folks here as well. Back, and Julie, correct me if I'm wrong, and Tricia, correct me if I'm wrong, and Janice, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but when we ceased becoming a health district, it became a county health department because they're to maintain community input and advice from many sectors of the community. That was created to really provide perspective that the commissioners could really use in terms of, and public health, we folks can really use in terms of making policy decisions and forming policy around public health in the county. So back, because you guys are so diverse and you bring so many sectors together, so many perspectives together, you're an incredibly valuable resource for input into health. Public health policy and decisions in Clark County. And I just wanted to, you've taken a number of issues on meth, children's health, protecting groundwater, nutrition in schools, pandemic flu, food access, integrated primary care, and planning and all that. You've got all this done through volunteer work. Just want to, just before we get jazzed up to talk about the topic today, I just want to revisit some of the things you guys back has been really instrumental on. Some of it was the integrated behavioral health primary care clinic at the Center for Community Health. And actually, that was created there, and that's even moving further. We're an early adopter region here for integrating primary care, chemical dependency, and mental health. And a lot of that got started here, and you guys were a great influence on that. You were instrumental in recommending and creating a meth tax in support of prevention for methamphetamine complications and methamphetamine use. You took a leadership role in creating the health element, which is part of the county, which was put forward as part of the county comprehensive land use plan. And even though the entire health element is not in there, the county comprehensive plan does include considerations around health whenever development is being done or planned. And you were all instrumental in making that happen. You advocated for a 1% property tax to support public health core responsibilities. And you influenced changes in school vending machine policies. So that had real role in a lot of these things. So, before I turn it over to your chair, just wanted to, and Trevor is was going to introduce a facilitator and talk about the rest of the afternoon, but the reason, well, first of all, a lot of you expressed interest in the topic of adverse childhood experiences, but just from my experience as a public health physician, as a health officer, now as a public health director, it's become clear to me that, having I've been involved in a lot of issues around environmental change and health, but it's become clear to me and many others in public health that what happens not only in early childhood, but even during pregnancy and preconception, really has a great impact on what our likelihood of either being healthy many years down the road or facing an increased risk of chronic disease. I've become convinced that maternal and child health, and certainly aspects of maternal and child health, are essential if we're going to prevent chronic disease and improve the health of our population. So, and you all guys decide. So for me, that's key. And actually, our public health colleagues around the state are moving in that direction, and around the nation are moving in that direction as well. So you guys decided to take it on. I'm going to turn it over now to Trev, and you want to talk a little bit more and introduce Sarah.
Absolutely. Let's take a brief moment here to introduce our facilitator, our guest speaker today. Laura Porter directs the Adverse Child Experiences ACEs for the Institute for Foundation for Healthy Generations. She oversees analysis of ACE and resilience data from Washington adults, works with local and state leaders to embed developmental neuroscience and resilience findings into policy practice and community norms. She's an award-winning public servant, best known for directing systemic improvements to the child and family services system in Washington State. For 17 years, Laura's worked with Washington State officials and community and tribal leaders to embed ACE study and related neuroscience and resilience findings into policy practice. Laura and her colleagues developed a unique model for improving the capacity of communities to improve their study results for a small investment. Communities using the model have documented reductions in rates of 7 major social problems and adverse child experience scores among adults. Laura is more importantly a mother of 3 children and a grandmother to 3 precious grandchildren. Give her endless delights. Thank you for joining us today. We're looking forward to the facilitation and overview.
Thank you. So how many of you were at the Southwest event a couple days, whatever that was?
Collaborative?
So I'm going to ask for your forgiveness because I am going to do some repeating because we wanted to an initial presentation just to get us all on the same page with a body of information, most of which is also in the booklets that I've given you, which are hot off the press. Literally, let's see, the Southwest event was Tuesday, Monday night. These came out and I was at the coffee shop copying them for that and for you. So there were a lot of brand new data in them, and we'll talk more about that. But I want to just get started with a story. And the reason I'm going to tell this story is that I'm going to be talking about adverse childhood experience and resilience. And over the many years that I've talked about those topics, folks get really impatient about listening to the power of adverse childhood experience in population health, because they really want everyone to be resilient. And that tends to be sort of people set their sights on resilience as a goal. And that started to bother me a little bit because in order to be resilient, you need to have adversity. So resilience by definition is doing well in the face of adversity. And I think there's something else we should set our sights on, and I'm starting to think of it as flourishing. Flourishing means to prosper with sustained and continuous and steady growing into well. That process of always becoming well in its largest sense. And when I think of flourishing, I think of a trip I got to take last winter. My daughter teaches English in Austria, and that leaves me a free place to stay in Austria. It's awesome. And she taught here for several years and then decided, since she was single, she didn't own a home, she could go overseas and teach, which is fabulous. So I went to spend winter break with my daughter, and one of her teaching colleagues said, your mom cannot come here without coming to my family for Christmas Eve, Christmas, and the day after Christmas in southern Italy. And so my daughter and I got on trains and planes and went all the way down into the heel of the boot in southern Italy to near Bari, absolutely exquisite place. But more importantly, the people we met were so inspiring. So we were greeted at the airport, and they had said, oh yes, of course, we'll pick you up at the airport. It turned out it was a 2-hour drive from their home, so they had come in the morning to get us. And by the way, Italians don't do morning, so that was really a big sacrifice on their part to do. And we arrived in their home, and all the way in the car, they were saying, oh, it's so exciting that you get to come this year because we have a special person this year. And we were gathering with between 25 and 30, depending on the moment, relatives with grandma and grandpa, aunties and uncles, husbands and wives, and cousins, and the first grandchild, Arianna. And she was 15 months old, and when they said her name, they did that. Their arms flew all around every single time. Arianna! Arianna! And we arrived in the home, and everybody just like scooted onto the floor with Arianna. Like that was the home greeting. And when we got up the next morning, they gave us a little coffee and biscotti and swooped us off into a car to tour their area while the entire rest of the family was cooking. And they cooked and cooked while we were gone. And when we got back, the whole living room was set up, you know, a long table all ready, all set, filled the living room for the 28 guests. And we were trying to help because in our culture, two women who are guests, we should be helping, right? No, we couldn't help. In fact, one of the sons in the family was saying, if you absolutely must help, then move this chair to here and move it back, because that's all we're going to let you do. So that was kind of the culture of this family. And lo and behold, in that afternoon, while they were still cooking, little Arianna started lifting one leg, and the next leg, and the next leg, and her uncle jumps up in the living room and says, everyone, Arianna wants to dance! And everyone flew in from the kitchen. The entire family stood in a circle, swooped the tables that were all set out of the way, unset them, so that they could all stand in a circle and dance with Arianna exactly in the way that she was dancing. And when her little leg went up too high and she fell onto her bum, her grandpa swooped in under and started rocking her. And we didn't even hear a cry because his comfort was so immediate. Amazing to me to watch this dynamic in the family with little Arianna, clearly a cherished new member of the family, moment by moment, second by second. And we stayed up that night for what was the meal, Christmas Eve, and it was 8 hours. Christmas Eve was 8 hours of meal, course after course after course. And then we get later and later and later, and my daughter and I started going, Arianna's going to have to go to sleep because she's pretty late. And yeah, I'm pretty sure Arianna's going to go to sleep. No, Arianna didn't go to sleep. She stayed up with us celebrating, and every time she got a little fussy, one of her uncles would jump out of his chair and say, Arianna needs more pasta! And they would all run in and get giant platters of pasta, and Arianna would eat, and get happy again. We're like, okay, we thought we knew. Well, the babies needed sleep, but maybe they just eat pasta. And, you know, it was an amazing experience because not only was Arianna treated in that way in this family, but we watched a couple of things that really let us know that this is just how their family works. One was, I asked my daughter's colleague who'd invited us, are you a little jealous because you were the youngest in the entire family before Arianna? And she said, oh no, this is exactly how I was treated all my whole life. This is normal, right? And we also watched while one of the cousins on the night after Christmas got a migraine. And quietly, the word went around the living room, and the games we were playing shifted from very loud card games to very soft card games. A couch was cleared off, and the cousin lay down in our same room. All of the conversation quieted down, and we adjusted everything about the tone of what was happening so she could remain with the family in the celebration on this evening. When I think of flourishing, I think of that fluid taking care, the noticing, and the true celebration of really the sacredness of being human. And that's what I want us to set our sights on when we talk about shifting public health. Let's shift it toward flourishing instead of just thinking about some tiny step. We are creating those cultural norms every day in our lives, and we actually can make the shift to flourishing. So with that, I am going to talk about, what a bundle of science that we're now calling near science. So it's neuroscience, epigenetics, adverse childhood experience, and resilience. And what we found is that thinking about changing policy and practice and norms, when you use any one of these sciences, doesn't quite get us a complete picture, that this bundle of science is more useful. And so we're talking about it in terms of near. And the first part of it is the neuroscience. So I just wanted to say that Ariana is growing up on what is represented by the left side of this chart, in a very safe environment with a lot of nurturing behaviors. But all of us have a relatively neutral start at conception. All of us have experiences that shape our biology, that we adapt to biologically. All of us then experience society's response to those adaptations, and that leads to our health across the life course. So for someone growing up in a very safe environment, they would develop fairly typical characteristics. They might be more relationship-oriented, more process-oriented, able to talk things through. Even in a very emotional state, they can have a rational conversation to resolve an issue. They might be more multi-focused and not need to be so mission-oriented as other people. And they also might not have the same sense of responsiveness and danger. So people with these characteristics, it's helpful to the species if we have to live in a very safe world, but actually makes the species a little bit vulnerable if we have to live in a very dangerous world, because we're biologically adapted to safety. In our society, we tend to accept people that have adapted in that particular way. And so that group of people tends not to experience as much rejection as the group of people that grow up on the right side of the screen, in a dangerous world. By danger, I mean either episodic, where you don't know what's coming next, or danger that lasts more than 20 minutes for prolonged periods of time, so that the cortisol levels and stress neurotransmitter levels are higher in the bloodstream, and that leads to biological adaptations of readiness for danger. And those people also develop pretty typical characteristics. They can be more hypervigilant, more hyperresponsive. They can be very mission-focused, very directed toward a particular goal. They can also become withdrawn or numb. We tend to have one response or the other in our adaptations. And what's interesting to me is that our society has built pretty good programming to help people who grow up in the safe world to navigate difficult and dangerous circumstances. We have stranger danger lessons in schools. We have support for people. We have much more normalized now teaching martial arts to children. A lot of team sports is organized in a way that helps people develop skills around dealing with stressors in life. But we haven't yet really developed the accommodations and the programming to help people who grew up in a very dangerous world and who've adapted biologically to that world to help them function well in a safe world. And I believe that's part of our generation's task, is to figure out what those things are, to develop those, and to test them. Unfortunately, how do we relate to people who are hypervigilant, hyper-responsive, quick to anger, slow to soothe, maybe have a difficult time taking on multiple goals, proceeding through life? How do we? What's our response as a society?
To control them.
Try to control them.
We're irritated.
We're irritated.
We kick them out.
It's generally punitive. We separate them. One of my colleagues calls it the reject and eject policy. and you'll see that in the data that I'll show you in a little while, that societal response. And the neuroscientist we've worked most closely with says that the difficulty isn't the adaptation to danger, it's when society's expectations doesn't match the biology of who we've become. That's where we get the difficulty, where folks end up not being able to function in the world in which they live. So that neuroscientist that we've worked most closely with is Dr. Martin Heischer. He is a total rock star in the neuroscience world. We're so lucky to have been able to work with him. He came 9 consecutive years to teach lay audiences in Washington, and he continues to consult every publication we pass by Marty. He's in charge of biopsychiatry and neurobiology research at McLean Hospital and teaches psychiatry, neuroscience, et cetera, at Harvard University. And his undergraduate degrees are in technology, and so he's actually been the developer of some of the brain scanning tools that have allowed us to understand more about neural adaptation to toxic stress. And Marty's work has been replicated in a couple of other places, so we're very confident that our brains have sensitive and critical developmental periods for brain regions as we're growing up. So when we're very first born, we don't need to be able to do everything, right? What do we need to be able to do?
Eat.
Poop
and sleep.
Sleep, wake, regulate sleep, wake, regulate temperature, heartbeat, right? We need to be able to recognize a face. That's one of the very earliest things. Hopefully it's mom who's there to feed you and protect you, but we definitely can see a face early on. And the shape of a breast, we know what that is even on the first moment. So early on, as we grow, brain development is sequential. And our brains are developing region by region more and more fully and preparing for the next phase and what we'll be needing in the next phase of our life. And Dr. Teich's research has shown that from the very first spark of life, our relationships, our experience is shaping both the functioning of our brain regions and also the mass of our brain regions. And in the earliest period of life, the first 3 years, 2 brain regions that are very sensitive to stress are the hippocampus and the amygdala. And they're part of the limbic system. The system in our brain is our fight-flight response to danger. And the amygdala is the brain region that actually sends the messaging out that we should ramp up our stress chemicals and be ready to respond. In fact, it happens so fast that we just respond, right? Our experience of it is just a physiological response to danger. The amygdala is what is ordering that response to the HPA axis. The hippocampus is the brain region that orders the recycling of those stress chemicals so that we can then calm. And so they work together, ramp up and be able to calm. And the regulation of those two functions is really important throughout our lives. The hippocampus is also known for its role in our learning and memory, which kind of makes sense because it's bringing us into the space where we can make sense, the psychological space where we can then process information and be able to learn and remember. But the hippocampus is born with little, when we're born, we have little baby or granule cells in the hippocampus that are pre-programmed to blossom at puberty, pre-puberty. And so we don't always notice toxic stress impact to that part of the brain right away. Dr. Teich's work says there's a 9 to 13 year delay where we don't really see the full impact of the trauma or stress until we fail to see the blooming of those cells in puberty. And you'll hear speakers say, well, there are two big times for developing the brain mass. One is in the first 3 years, and the other is during adolescence. And the reason that second one is there is because of these granule cells blossoming, developing the second phase of brain mass. But cortisol in particular is toxic to those developing baby cells. And so it can kill the cells, and so we can fail to see that extra brain mass produced in the hippocampus in particular. And there's a couple of other parts of the brain that Marty talks about that are really important for recognizing that there can be delays in symptoms. So we sometimes, I'll hear people say, well, I know this child who had horrific trauma before she was 2, and she's now in 3rd grade and she's just fine. And of course we want her to be just fine. And it's important to continue to watch and be prepared to support, because she may in fact have some more effects later on in her life. And I've had many, many occasions where parents have walked up to me after a talk where I included this, where they say, thank you so much. I thought there was a whole other trauma, because my puberty age child all of a sudden is having these difficulties. And now I understand that it probably isn't a whole other trauma. It's probably still that early childhood trauma that I did know about. And so I'll stop hounding my child to tell me about the new thing, right? So it changes the nature of relationships when we understand these processes. So while I'm totally a big believer in investing in early childhood, I get concerned when I hear people talking about only investing in safeguarding early childhood, because Dr. Teicher and other leading scientists' work shows us that there are other sensitive and critical developmental periods for other brain regions that we need to pay attention to. So from early childhood all the way up through about age 9 or 10, the corpus callosum is very dramatically affected by toxic stress. It's that superhighway that connects the right-left side of the brain. It's critical for integrating math and language, rational and creative thought. It's essential for all the STEM sciences. You got to have a corpus callosum that's going to help you do that kind of integration, complex thinking work. And interestingly enough, Dr. Teicher found that there are 3 main factors that are most impactful for outcomes related to toxic stress. So one is the kind of experience. The second is gender, and the third is age. So we can see why age, because of sequential development, age is so important when something happens. But gender shows up here when we talk about the corpus callosum, because the biggest effect for boys on the corpus callosum is when boys experience neglect from infancy through the toddler years. The biggest effect for girls on the corpus callosum is when girls experience sexual abuse at around age 9 to 10. So when I hear this, let's move all the resources to early childhood, I get concerned for our girls. Because unfortunately in our society, age 9 and 10 is a time when girls are very vulnerable to sexual assault, and a time when impacts of the corpus callosum can change the trajectory of their life. So not when sexual assault is ever okay, but especially in this age, it has just profound effects on brain functioning and balance. So on middle childhood, the right temporal gyrus is the part of the brain very affected by toxic stress. The Center for Spoken Language and Social Cognition, our ability to pick up social cues. So I'm watching you all the time. It's right after lunch. You're a little bit... wish you could get a nap, right? I can pick up those social cues, but some people can't. And it's important to recognize that we might need to verbalize the social cues in order for everyone to have an even and fair start in being able to function socially in groups of people. Because some people actually don't perceive the social cues that are being given out. The right temporal gyrus is also associated with profound depression and suicide attempts. And Dr. Teicher's most recent research is actually about peer bullying. And he first found huge impacts on the right temporal gyrus for verbal abuse in the home and emotional abuse in the home. But after he started studying bullying, he found that peer bullying in those middle childhood years has just as big an impact on the development of this brain region as emotional and verbal abuse in the home. So when we know there's bullying, we should treat it as a life-threatening event. Bullying affects the part of the brain that can protect us from profound depression and suicide attempts. So it's a different way of thinking about growing up in childhood, that there are slices of time that really are about saving lives by stopping things that maybe adults think are kind of normal. Kids will be kids. But now that we understand the brain science, we can see we have to absolutely change that norm in order to save children's lives and adults' lives. So pre-puberty, the cerebellar vermis is the region most affected by toxic stress in terms of brain math and functioning. The vermis is associated with all diagnoses of mental illness. Some people call it the seat of mental health. And substance abuse, so the mental health substance abuse intersection, we can think of as held in some ways by the vermis. And the vermis is also a part of the brain that has the granule cells that are pre-programmed to blossom later, a 9 to 13 year delay. And it's one of the reasons that Dr. Teicher and Dr. Bellis and other researchers that are working on this story say that we see life challenges pre-puberty and we see diagnoses of mental illness in early adulthood. That represents the delay that they would anticipate through their research. And into adulthood, we're seeing effects to the frontal lobe, the cortex, and that affects thinking and judgment, and most popularly now people are talking more about executive function. And when I think about this group, I think one of the connections to those of you who are working on clean water and restaurant health, et cetera, and not necessarily working on child and family issues, is that executive function is our ability to set a goal and take action toward achieving that goal. It's necessary for every form of public health participation on the part of folks in their everyday lives. So it's in everyone's interest that not only do we build, we build an environment in which executive functions are developed fully and in a healthy way, but also that we learn to accommodate for executive dysfunction where it's happening. And we'll talk a little bit more. So Deborah Gray actually is in Washington. She's one of the nation's leaders about working with people with executive dysfunction that has its origins in stress. And she talks about the influences of toxic stress on processing load, so how much our brain can actually take at one time, on verbal memory, on working memory, on our ability to generalize from one piece of information to a larger context or subject, our initiating, our ability to know the start place for something, and also to have the energy and the will to take the first actions. It also has effect on when to stop, understanding when to stop. And then organizing and planning, and I think those are probably the most commonly thought of in terms of executive function. But these all weave together. And Dr. Gray gives us some advice here, although her books are also fabulous, or I'll read more. But some of the advice are to ask what part people are getting and what part they're not getting, and not start at the beginning with an explanation, just fill in the part they didn't get. Because people with executive dysfunction get really tired listening over and over and over because they only got one. They only missed one little piece. Right? And so we tend to start all over as opposed to just giving the piece that they don't get. In fact, I said that in a workshop on Tuesday, and I had three people walk up to me afterwards and say, "Thank you so much. That's so frustrating. Thank you for telling these people that." That's a common experience that we get, given that three people is a lot of people in a tiny workshop to walk up and thank you. Ask people to tell you when their brains are full and give breaks for them to take a physical break, not more mind work, but just go for a walk, whatever physical kinds of break you can give. Use visuals, especially for choice making. Decision tools are very, very important. For some people, it's hard to hold verbal information about the first choice in their mind while they're hearing the second choice. They don't necessarily have the working memory to hold on to both choices at once. But if there's a diagram or a decision aid of some kind, they're good at the choice making. They just can't hold the options if they're all verbal. She talks about speaking slowly and seven word sentences, both of which I have to practice. And this one's interesting, using white space and having start and stop places on forms and instructions, that we tend to have forms that have the part that the customer fills out and then the part that the administration fills out and maybe the part that the fiscal just fills out. And it's very confusing to people who have a difficult time navigating the start and the stop. So simple things like a little more white space and telling people, "This is your part, this is where you start, here's where you stop." And then remembering the bond, so making sure that we're taking care for stretches, for breaks, but also our own bond. And in most of the work that I do, the most important message I think I can leave is we first change ourselves. So staying relaxed as the helper or the administrator is really profoundly helpful to somebody who has a hard time with their emotional regulation. They essentially are mirroring your calmness in order to help with their own emotional regulation. And if you start ramping up, they will too, because they'll have a difficult time staying in the rational space, especially if it's stressful. And people coming for help, especially if they're in a life challenging situation of some kind, it is stressful no matter what we do to try to make it less stressful. It's hard to ask for help. It's a lot easier to give help than it is to receive. So the last tip I want to give about from the neurosciences is that every person actually has a unique perception of the world we're living in. We each experience the world differently. And neuroscientists are now starting to identify what is essentially a switching mechanism where information from our five senses are coming into our body and our brain. And the brainstem and the limbic system have an elaborate system for either filtering that information all the way in so we can think it through using the cortex, or switching it out so in favor of survival. And of course, it's not just an on-off switch. And so part is coming in, part is out. And so we're actually each experiencing this room differently from each other. Our perception of reality differs. And I know this personally because I have a sister with schizophrenia, and I've been her closest support for all of my life. I'm 2 years younger, so I wasn't there the first 2 years of her life. But that's an extreme example where I have a pact with her where I can ask how she's experiencing reality, and she will tell me. That's our agreement. She will tell me. And I don't intervene unless she's experiencing terror. So we have a pact, so set some boundaries around it. And I can tell you, it's sometimes really uncomfortable to hear how she's experiencing reality, because it's real different than the way I do. But what I've heard from her and what I've heard from people in audiences is that for people who actually experience reality even a little differently, maybe not as much as my fifth, there's no place they feel safe to say. So opening up the space for an honest conversation about how are we experiencing this is a rare opportunity for people to feel belonging, to feel welcomed, to feel like their life and experience counts too. It's a simple thing, and it makes a really big difference. I don't know if you can imagine having no one in your entire life that you could say how you experienced your last hour, but many, many people have no one that they could tell. And that's, these are simple accommodations that require very little change in the service system to make a huge difference in people's lives. So in my little mirror, the E is for epigenetics, brand new part of the field of genetics, where scientists are learning about how our, what is it, 60 billion genetic instructions that are organized in our chromosomes are actually read by the body and allow us to actually express the genetic predispositions that we inherit from our mother and our father, or not to express. So there are chemical responses that allow the genes to either be amplified or to be silenced, essentially. And that is the field of epigenetics, the study of the expression and how experience affects the expression of our genes. So we used to think like DNA was like the was going to tell us everything about how we become humans. And now we understand that DNA is more like a script. So if we think about when Romeo and Juliet was produced in 1916, that was a very different kind of production than when it was produced in 1996. Same story, same author, very different production. And that's kind of the way we're understanding now epigenetics, that our experience is actually shaping our genetic expression, and some of that shaping is heritable. So the best example I can give right now is from Dr. Seif, who's quoted in that booklet, where in a recent one of his articles, he talks about rats in a lab where the adult rats were conditioned to become afraid of cherry blossoms. And then they had the rat pups, and there were no cherry blossoms. They separated the parents from the pups and introduced cherry blossoms into the environment of the pups, and the pups were terrified. So scientists are now thinking that especially anxiety kinds of and response to perceived danger is likely heritable through an epigenetic channel. Most of the study so far in epigenetics has been like that, where they're studying something that we might perceive as negative that's being carried in the epigenetic expression. But the same author is saying he thinks nurturing behavior has tremendous potential, especially in the earliest phase, for being a pathway for a positive expression that then would become heritable for the next generation. So stay tuned. Epigeneticists are going to teach us a lot. And what they teach us really is about why and how some whole population groups' lives feel harder because they are harder. So what's that about? It's not just about their experience in this lifespan. It's also about historic trauma and the experience that's heritable through epigenetics. So I want to, before I talk a little bit about adverse childhood experience, I'm not going to talk a lot about it, but my understanding is you've had workshops on ACEs, so awesome. One of my colleagues, Erin Havick, was here. Erin and I talked about what slides you do, so I actually know what you saw. But before we do that, I want to just say that we are living in a time that's possibly one of the largest public health discoveries of all time. I might argue that it is, and I'll tell you why I would argue that it is. But the public health discovery most of us really know about is about water. And imagine that you're a friend of Dr. John Snow's in the early 1850s, when cholera is rolling across Europe and the British Isles, and each time there's a wave of cholera coming through the cities, tens of thousands of people die. you could be all of your family fine in the morning, and by nightfall, half of the people are dead from the fall. And Dr. John Snow is the kind of scientist where he's like, I just can't line up all the facts, because the belief of the day is that death was caused by miasma, the smell in the air, the smell. And so he was like, that doesn't make any sense. I can't line up those facts, because people aren't dying of lung symptoms, they're dying of intestinal symptoms. So something else has to be going on. And so he started what we now talk about as shoe leather epidemiology. He started putting little X's on the map each time there was a death in the big epidemic that ran through in 1854. And it didn't take very long, cholera is so deadly, for him to see a very clear picture with all of these little X's around one water pump, the Broad Street pump. So if he came running to your house and he said, I've got it, it's the water, what would you do? You're so quiet. What would you do?
You're crazy.
You might say you're crazy, because the paradigm of that time was, we already know what the answer is. It's miasma, right? So part of what happened during that time was this pushback. That can't be true. Among the people who thought, he might be right, what would they do?
Not drink the water.
You wouldn't drink the water. Yeah.
What's the alternative?
Huh?
What's the alternative? You can't just say you're not going to drink the water.
They started drinking water out of different pumps, because the cholera epidemic, those deaths were around one pump with a few spotted other places. Later on, they found it was water from one river and not the other. So they were able then to trace which pumps were getting water from which river. So people do two things. They tell everyone, and they change their own behavior and their own sphere of influence. That's, in a big public health discovery, that's what we do. It would be decades before we had germ theory, before we knew what it was in the water. and it would be over 100 years before there were clean water lines. So the first things that happen in a huge public health discovery are us. We tell everyone, and we begin to think about how we change ourselves and what our sphere of influence is. But Dr. Snow happened to have the authority to have the handle removed from the pump. So sometimes our sphere of authority is just our own self or our family, and sometimes it's more like that kind of authority. And I would suggest to you that your committee has more of that level of authority, because you can influence large systemic decisions, like when Dr. Stone ordered the pump handle to be removed from the pump. So that takes us to the Adverse Childhood Experience Study, which you know a lot about. You might notice that I've added a whole other lower rung to the ACE pyramid. I added distort trauma. And as Dr. Ryanda and I talked over the years, and especially in the last 2 years, we realized that the epigenetic discoveries are making it really clear that historical trauma is a part of what leads to risk for ACEs. And ACEs then lead to risk for social, emotional, and cognitive adaptations, lead to health behavior risk, disease, disability, and social problems. But when Dr. Anda and Dr. Ben Scaletti, the two co-principal investigators of the ACE study, first developed their hypothesis, the neuroscience that I just talked about had not, none of those findings existed. That neuroscience is new. And so this was really a radically different hypothesis about what was driving risk. And from Dr. Anda's story, you can see the parallel to Dr. Stone's. Because Dr. Anda had won international awards for being on the team that developed the health surveillance system in the U.S. He then was on the team that helped develop the heart disease prevention strategies for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And he was bothered by what he saw in the heart disease data, because the facts didn't line up. They were dealing with the first three rungs, the top three rungs, and they all were about what are the risk factors for heart disease and how we lower those risk factors, we will lower disease. And in fact, we've had some really good progress in that way. But Dr. Anna said risk is not random in the population.
that can't be the whole answer. Something has to be driving the rest. Very similar story to Dr. Snow's, and he started looking at literature to sort out what might be driving the rest. So when he met Dr. Folletti and heard the story of Kaiser Permanente, he said, ah, this is what we need to learn more about. What about adverse experiences during childhood? So you know the 10 experiences that Dr. Enda and Dr. Folletti decided they would study? There are 5 indicators of family dysfunction. So having a mentally ill, depressed, or suicidal person in the home, a drug addicted or alcoholic family member. Parental discord, as they use the indicators of divorce, separation, or abandonment, but what they were actually trying to get at was the discord in the family, not necessarily the loss of the parent. Witnessing violence against the mother. In the original study, it was only against the mother. In the state data that I'll show you, it's against either parents. Incarceration of any family member. Again, incarceration they thought of as a proxy for the stress associated with illegal behavior and all the secrets that go with that. And you also lose a parent if they're incarcerated, right? So you have that double level of stress for the children. And then they studied 3 kinds of abuse and 2 kinds of neglect. Dr. Inn and Dr. Flitty never imagined that this list of 10 was all of the kinds of stress that would be driving disease in the population. What they were after were preventable factors where there was good solid literature base and where they could look at the impact of a constellation of kinds of experiences on development. What they found was that accumulation matters. We all know the ADA score from 0 to 10 as a way to study the accumulation of these different categories of experience. So quickly, the ACE study findings. ACEs are highly interrelated. They almost never come in ones. Where there's one ACE category, in 87% of the population, there are more than one. They're common. About 2/3 of Washington adults have at least one ACE. 27% have 3 or more, and 5% have 6 or more. That's Washington data. Almost exactly the prevalence of the original study, interestingly enough. We're not very different than the population in San Diego that the original study looked at when we look at the state as a whole. The higher the ACE score, the higher the risk in the population for disease, disability, social problems, and productivity. The ACE score is a really good proxy measure for the dose of toxic stress in childhood. It reliably predicts the rates of problems in the population. And I just want to say something I don't say to very many groups, but I want to say it here, and that is that lots of folks are starting to say, oh yeah, we know about ACEs, but we really want to learn about all the different forms of toxic stress. And I think that's awesome. We ought to be learning all the time. But let's not lose this list of 10, and I'll tell you why. We have never had something that reliably predicted the rates of costly problems in the population before. When you can reliably predict the rates of costly problems, you can reliably predict the savings. It's the first time when we've had a metric that might open the door to a different kind of financing for public health, family support, neighborhood building work. We shouldn't lose track of the fact that that's a really powerful thing to have in our hands, and we can have that at the same time we're studying other kinds of stress.
So that's a very interesting statement, that ACEs are the most powerful known determinant of health.
Yes.
That's kind of paradigm shifting and mind-boggling.
Totally paradigm shifting.
And so you're making the statement that it's causal.
I am. And the reason is that in epidemiology, there's a gold standard for inferring cause.
Right.
And it was developed by Sir Bradford Hill. And there's 9 tests, and the ACE study meets all 9 tests.
Ah.
So it's as close as we get in epidemiology. Plus, the neuroscience now, at the time of the study, we didn't know why, the neuroscience now gives us the pathways that show us why. It's a great question. It's an important question, and it's important that you know why I would feel confident now. in the earliest years when I first started talking about ACEs, when I got that question, I went like this. Because some of these facts have unfolded just in the last 5 years, right? Some of the neuroscience that tells the pathways that are new.
Well, it's the one thing you're never supposed to do, which is relate causality to things that are absolutely, clearly, for sure, connected that way. It's correlational, but not causal. Anyway,
yeah.
Sorry. But
yeah.
That's pretty powerful stuff right there.
But it meets all 9 tests, and that is the gold standard of the day. So I'm not saying that we couldn't get into an era where we had another paradigm, but for right now, this is, and it's the most powerful known determinant of health for 2 reasons. One is the higher the ACE score, the higher so many different challenges in society. So the breadth of impact is huge. And then the amount of population attributable risk, the amount of each of those is very large. And when you get that dual dimension, it's pretty easy to say it's the most powerful. So I'm not going to show you very many ACE charts. I just have 2 here just to illustrate. So along the bottom, those are ACE scores from 0 to 5 or more. And the vertical axis is the percentage of the population with asthma. So you can see the stair-step dose-response relationship. That strong graded relationship is one of the 9 tests for causality. It is the one that is most visual. So that's the reason we talk about it more than the other 8, but it needs all 8. And this is where we see anxiety. And I can show you dozens of these. We see the same kind of stair-step relationship for mental, physical, behavioral disorders, many social problems, productivity problems, injury on the job. In fact, one of our most recent and interesting partners in Washington is labor and industries. ACEs are undoubtedly driving the business rate for workers' comp. We can now see that in the Washington data. So this is the range of problems that are driven by ACEs in the population. You can see risks, prevalent disease, mental health and social problems, and intergenerational transmission of ACEs. We are actually measuring all of these things in the Washington Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System survey, which is the random telephone survey of adults in our state. It's a partnership between the CDC and the state health departments, and every state does it. But we've systematically added questions in order to learn about the relationship between ACEs and adult adversity, to learn about the life course, and also to learn about ACEs and resilience. We added the 5 household functioning ACE questions so that we begin to get clues about the rates of transmission of ACEs from one generation to the next. So when you're on the phone, you can't ask about abuse or neglect because you're talking to the adult. It's not going to be a valid answer. But you can ask whether that adult you're talking to has a mental illness, has had or has a drug or alcohol problem. You know their marital status, you know if there are children in the home, you know if they've been a victim of family violence, because we have added those questions to the BERFIS, and we know we added to the BERFIS adult incarceration. So now we can look at from ACE scores of 0 to 5 and approximate what's happening to children in households across the state, because we've intentionally gone after that picture. So ACEs don't just reliably predict single problems. We also reliably predict co-occurring problems in people's lives. This slide is from Dr. Anda, and it's from the original study. It's not Washington data. It's from the original study. Along the bottom, a score 0 to 8, 7 or 8 at the last bar. And this is the mean number of co-occurring problems from this list on the right-hand side. Dr. Anda generated this list based on looking at different body systems. And we see for people with ACE scores of 0, the mean number of co-occurring problems is 1.5, whereas people with very high ACE scores of 7 or 8, the mean number of co-occurring problems is 4.5. So we might hear people say, my life just feels harder, because it is harder when you're managing multiple multiple challenging kinds of problems in your life. So in our office, we were curious, if ACEs pile up and they have this powerful an effect, then what about ACEs plus adult adversity? We're trying to learn more about life course to find more opportunities to prevent across the life course. We feel that if you can prevent the escalation of problems, then that's a pretty good thing to do. And we also are concerned about helping parents in ways that allow them to protect their children better from high ACE scores. Parents are the most powerful people for preventing ACEs in the next generation. So we're looking to understand life course, specifically with an eye to parents. So this chart is about people 18 to 64. And what we did was we said everybody represented by this set of bars has three or more ACEs, plus they have one or more, zero to three, of the major stress categories there that we see in adulthood. So homelessness, incarceration, chronic illness, separation or divorce, severe depression, and work-related injury or illness. Now we know from Washington data that having a higher ACE score is predictive, increases the risk of having at least one of those. So we were curious about how does having this pileup affect people's functioning in their daily lives. So we looked at this variable of having 15 to 30 days where you can't do your usual activities. 15 to 30 days out of the last month where you can't do your usual activities due to some kind of disabling condition defined very broadly by the person on the phone, by the respondent. And you can see that among people with zero ACEs, with three ACEs plus zero of those adult adversities, about 4% are missing half to all of their monthly functionality. About three ACEs plus one, about 5%. Three ACEs plus two adult adversities jumps all the way to 18%. And three ACEs plus three of those adult adversities jumps all the way to 57.5%. 57.5% of the population would have both a score of three or more plus three adult adversities are having a hard time participating in their own lives, half to all of them. So these kind of findings are applicable in terms of our policies and practice, and I want to give you one example of how a health department used this information. They realized that they had a lot of no-shows in their WIC program, and they were really frustrating that they would make appointments and nobody would show up over and over and over. And understanding this data allowed them to say, maybe they're having a hard time showing up for anything. Plus, if you understand this, plus the executive function challenges, then it makes sense that not showing up would be a pattern of people that have these kinds of experiences in their background. So they made WIC a drop-in day on, this was in a rural community, a drop-in day on the same day as the food bank was open, and created a space for children to play. And all of a sudden, their WIC enrollment tripled. And moms came and spent all day and met each other. And it began to set up a social network of support for these moms. And they learned that not only was it that they couldn't navigate their lives to make it at a particular moment in time, but also that for most of them, public transportation couldn't pick them back up at the end of an hour. They had to stay because the bus wasn't coming back by, and they had thought all those things through. So a drop-in, they ended up increasing their WIC revenue because you get paid by the WIC enrollment, and also strengthening the social network around those moms. So this is the percent of population with three or more ACEs. And you can see in Clark County that you have one area that has, in the yellow area, that has between 34 and 38%. It's the second highest category. And this is the population that has six or more. So we look at both because you can end up with a high percentage of three or more, but lots of folks have zero and lots of folks have six, right? You don't want to wash out the picture. And in Clark County, It is really important to take a look at the six or more because your map changes. If you have this that same area, part of Vancouver, with very high percentage of people with six or more ACEs, plus the,
Washougal,
also really high percentage. So I just want you to talk for a minute at your tables about, did these maps surprise you? Did you, would you know this about your communities, given what ACEs predict? What do you think about these maps? They're also in your booklets, if it's hard to see. I'll just give you about 4 minutes to have some conversation.
No, that's great. That's a high end of the number. Okay. He was pretty sane. Well, he said on the phone very clearly, I will inform him that we have made our decision. And usually when he does that, right, I have been on the other end of that sort of scenario, and he tends not to budge at all. So that's really good. Okay, and 3.5 is good. Okay. No. I'm sorry I'm so dumb, but can we just have one little clarifying sort of conversation here? Yeah. And you guys are definitely the experts on all of these. But she was talking about someone else, I don't know who it was, but they were like, no, this has to go outside the box and normal, blah, 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 health, blah, blah, blah. Then if you look at the deliverables, I am scratching my head. And remember, I'm not a health person. I'm just an administrator or school district people. But I'm like, how is that working out exactly? You have to get out. Okay. So, Jan, should we take it with a grain of salt, or? Oh. Yeah. I don't know, Jan. But that's okay. So is she getting that by the secretary research? Is she getting it from the bed? She's making it up on her own. But see, for me it is, here are your outcomes. You must meet these outcomes. People can chat all they want about the outside of that, but togetherness in the last 10 years. Well, he had some, which I thought was funny. Yeah, because they're both like, maybe I have this wrong, but I think they're from the same neighbor. Okay. But at least he's, yeah. I was like, what are the chances of this happening? From all the places in the world that you don't even know. So that was kind of fun. I thought it was fun. I thought the summit was fun. But it's fun for me that I get to participate in the summit, but I don't have like a serious dog fight. But Katina got that news that they got the higher amount.
I didn't know.
Okay. So, okay, just a little bit more clarifying. You have to have, so you're going to give out 4 to 6 of these in the state. You have to have a population base of 100,000.
And they've already voted.
And within our Southwest region, Duella? And our region is, again, okay, I got that. Because that's ESC 113 and then 114. Except for parts of Tacoma, I think, are. No, I don't know if Tacoma's the one. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. But that's the frame for me. But then, are we. So this is confusing too. Are we expected to serve that full region if we get it, or just the part we apply for? That's crazy as well. That's a little crazy to me.
Okay, let's hear what came up for you.
Why don't you decide?
Why
don't you
decide?
Then
they're
totally going to eliminate.
No. No surprise.
No surprise.
Aligned with socioeconomic
status.
Is it?
Who's the person, our job staff, is in charge of this?
Well, you have to.
Because there was another gal, that was the Red Hawk gal, yeah. Gal that was high up there, and she was at the Prevention Alliance meeting, and she's the one in charge. Okay.
Yeah.
They were about this too.
Yeah, that's probably
the problem. They were talking about it. I probably should take it. But you know what I mean.
We are building for that.
I'm wondering if we should take a break.
Let's take a break. Let's take a break until 10 after 2.
What if you don't know Rustin did this way?
Are you talking about putting things on the Help You survey, questions that specifically drive to ACEs?
Well, it would be kind of fun to get some of these questions that we try to ask.
Yeah.
And then we could actually.
In 8, 10, and 12, we have physical abuse and witnessing adult with adult violence. So we're starting to do some physical abuse to use the younger phase schools and use that information as a proxy. Right.
Yeah. Capturing everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
A few hundred times in silence. It takes that.
The data doesn't keep you alive?
Oh, just exhilarating. I'm a little shocked at some of it, actually. I can't believe it. The rich have such high scores. Well, 4 to 5. Nobody seems to, you know.
This is downtown Vancouver, right?
Well, that, yeah, that's actually just kind of, but still, I'm a little surprised that Yackel has such a low percent of
I think what about you last time? I haven't heard of it. Really good.
No.
My mom, she was coming in and I had to pick her up at the airport.
And it's actually true.
That's true.
Yeah.
You don't trust me. The level of trust you have. What did I do? Did I do it? Did I do it from the first thought or experience or something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very high up. But and then
Tricia, Skamania County has a new TB case,
okay.
And I don't think they're capable anymore. I think we should help them out.
Okay.
Are you okay with that?
Yeah. I think Monica's there today.
I'm responding because Skamania called me first. I think I don't even care about having them pay us or anything. I think we should just help them out.
Who are you sending it to, Monica?
I'm sending it to Diane, Monica, and do you want me to copy you, too?
Good. Okay. So the question they said is, what should we do? Is that what they're
asking? Yeah, can we? I mean, I think we can even manage it, really.
Okay.
It's like one TV case.
Right.
In terms of our total budget, I'll copy you. I want to copy Kirby also.
Right.
thinking about my best patient group and the work you do. Okay. So they send it to the patient.
Yeah.
It's like you There is a way to talk about it. Yeah.
Yeah, you always have to be like,
you need to be more equipped to deal with it.
Okay, let's read the meeting.
Very good. Very good, Lord.
And my plan is I'm going to show you a little bit more.
Are you trying?
Mm-hmm.
Am I draining you?
I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about what we're learning from the Washington adults about resilience. And then we're going to do some action planning where we're all working together. So that's where we're headed. This chart is population attributable risk, and epidemiologists can calculate the amount of a disease or condition that's attributable or driven by a disease agent. So you all know population attributable risk because you've all seen charts about the amount of lung disease that's attributable to smoking, for example. So it's the same mathematical calculation. All of this data is about Washington adults except for suicide attempts, which is from the original study. What we've done here is taken an array of different conditions which are labeled on the outside of the circle, and the inside, the gray, we conceptualized as an oil slick. We made this graphic for the first time during the big Gulf oil spill. And that gray area represents the portion of each condition that is attributable to ACEs in the population. So I'm not going to read them all, but I just want to point out, for example, incarceration of adults. 61% of incarceration of adults in Washington is attributable to ACEs. Your health department for a county, I served as a county board of health member and a county commissioner in a smaller county than yours, but I can tell you at that time over 80% of our budget was criminal justice. I would have cared to see that stat. I would have wanted to know that. It's brand new. We're the only people in the nation that are able to calculate that because we added that question to the burden. So that's based on phone calls with people who are not currently in prison or jail. So it's probably an underestimation of attributable risk for incarceration. 22% of falls, 30% of current smoking. You can read all the way around. 51% of high risk for HIV. These are very, very large population attributable risk figures. For the most part, Dr. Anna says, in his whole career before he did this study, he was looking at 0.0 something. And that would be really an important thing to pay attention to because these are unheard of large population attributable risk numbers. 78% of IV drug use, 50% of painkillers to get high. ACEs are driving such a large percent of so many problems. That's another reason that we say that they're the most powerful determinant of health. What's exciting to me about this chart is that as we're successful reducing ACE scores, even a small amount from one generation to the next, we reduce all of these conditions concurrently. There's not another sort of strategic focus that I know of where you can have such a breadth of impact. And in my personal opinion, we don't all have to sit around a table and come to agreement on the one good strategy. We can weave the science through all of our systems and end up aligning neighborhood work, public health work, medical work, education work, etc., in ways that have a powerful impact on preventing ACEs in the next generation. And I believe we do that through dual generation approaches. Because the best way to prevent ACEs is to make parents' lives more supportive and less stressful so they can prevent ACEs in their children's lives. That's going to be the most powerful approach. But very few of our systems are set up for dual generation. That's kind of an unusual thing. Home visiting is, some in-school supports are. Head Start ECAP definitely has dual generation, but most of our systems aren't set up in that way, but with small adjustments can begin to have dual generation impacts that are pretty powerful, and that's one thing to think about as we're thinking about strategy. I also wanted to point out, because when we talked about the maps, one thing that came up was that the areas that have the highest percentage of six or more ACEs are also areas where you know there's deeper poverty. And that makes sense, and let me tell you why. So ACEs lead to cognitive behavioral and social kinds of challenges in life that make it more difficult to succeed in school and increase your risk of substance abuse. Difficulty succeeding in school, difficulty with relationships, difficulty with substance abuse, that's a fast track to end up in poverty in adult life in our culture. Because people who experience a lot of toxic stress, a small amount of stress during their adult life can feel like a big crisis. So what happens is impoverished people end up with these everyday stresses that are everyday crises for them. And we see the cases propelled from generation to generation. Dr. Blodgett, who researches at WSU, I think you've probably worked with Dr. Blodgett some in this community with your Compassionate Schools Initiative. He says poverty is like pouring gasoline onto a fire that is ancient. So we think it's propelling an intergenerational transmission rather than being the source. We certainly see very poor neighborhoods in which ACE scores among leaders are not high. And many cultures in the world where it would be absolutely out of the question for a child to be harmed, and they're very poor countries. So there's certainly cultural norms. We can't assume that because people are poor, their children are more at risk. I think that's kind of an old paradigm. Because people are more poor, they have bigger stressors. And if stress really matters in their lives for their functioning, you better give them more support. I think that's a more accurate way to think about the relationship between poverty, ACEs, and intergenerational transmission. Mm-hmm. Pretty different way. I mean, when I was in school studying sociology, that was not how I was taught. but the evidence is mounting to look at it more in terms of intergenerational transmission. I wanted to show you this one. So this is percentage of, on the left, the blue bars are adults 18 to 34 and their ACE scores, and on the right are ages 35 to 54. So when we think about intergenerational transmission, we can think about measuring it in terms of those five household functioning. We can get a sense that way. But we can also get a sense of what's happening in terms of trends in a county by looking at our ACEs higher in the younger or older adults. And in Clark County, the confidence intervals probably do overlap a little bit. So I could argue that you're even. But when we look at the numbers, it's 37% of Clark County younger adults have three or more ACEs, and 31% of your older adults have three or more ACEs. So, not conclusive, but it looks like your younger adults may be struggling more from a history of adversity than your older adults. Now, that's significant because people with high ACE scores die younger. In fact, the research says 20 years younger. And so as the population is aging in these studies, we have some people dropping off. So I think it's something to keep in mind that what you want is that to reverse, right? Over time, you want to see the younger adults having lower ACE scores than the older adults. It's a good metric to watch over time. But you have to, several people have told me, well, you won't see an ACE score change for 18 years because you have to change it from birth on. But actually, the information we're looking at from Dr. Bluff's work is pretty clear that kids are picking up additional ACE categories throughout their childhood, and that if we can stop the escalation of that, even mid-childhood, we'll see effects on the total ACE score by the time they're 18. So I don't think it is necessarily such a long-term goal. I think we can make a difference within a few years if we're intentional. So I'm going to skip to what we're measuring now in Washington about resilience. So the resilience literature, first of all, I want to say there's not any one definition of resilience in the literature. The definitions generally have at least two parts of them, adversity or trauma and doing well. Besides that, they're all over the map in terms of what the definitions are. In the booklet you have, we've defined it as navigating life well enough to be able to participate in protecting the next generation from high ACE scores. Really, we're trying to help people focus on that because we can make people's lives better in ways that won't protect children. And we want to do both, right? We want their lives better and them be able to protect children from having high ACE scores. And so we started systematically adding questions to the BRFSS, Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, based on literature about resilience factors that you can change. So the literature says you've got to build people's capabilities, you've got to build their attachment and belonging, and you've got to build their community, culture, spirituality, that sphere larger than self. A lot of the literature and a lot of our public investments are on the capabilities end of that spectrum. We try to improve individuals' capabilities. The difficulty there is that sometimes there's circular reasoning. So an example I have of that is actually a friend of mine who was adopted when she was 4 from China. She was severely neglected before she came to the U.S. And when she was little, her mom, she had a fabulous mom, amazingly nurturing family, she would hear people say, oh, she's so lucky to be in this family. You read to her every night. You know, she'll be great if she just has adults that care about her, and she could read pretty well by third grade, and these are the benchmarks, and mom, you should watch this. And they would say these benchmarks in front of the child. And nobody thought much about it. But when my little friend hit third grade and she couldn't read, her mom called me on the phone and said, she's crying. She's not going to be okay. She had heard people say, if you read fluently by third grade, then you're resilient and you're going to be okay. And the adults around her hadn't even thought that she was tracking what they were saying. Well, it turns out my little friend's brain isn't probably ever going to read very fluently. The neglect that she suffered means that she has trouble making meaning out of symbols. And so the kinds of help learning to read are not really going to ever fit her life very well. She has the best relational intelligence of anyone I've ever met in my life. She knows if I've had a haircut. She knows if I have a new shirt. She knows the names of all my siblings. She knows my birthday. She knows, right? She's tracking. Like, I think you're so lucky because now you have that new kitty, and kitties are really fun. So she's like, tuck, all making the connection. You gotta meet my friend. And she would love to work in an industry where she can use that relational intelligence. I'm sure she'll do very, very well there. So I try to encourage people to think about, let's build the capabilities that are a good match for the actual human being and not just check off a list, right? because some capabilities are difficult and never will be, regardless of whether they're on a resilience list or not. So that's just a caution about the capabilities list in the resilience literature. We have to make the right match. So we in particular didn't focus so much on capabilities, in part because public investments are so heavily in that arena. We wanted to look at the literature on the social-emotional support, on the belonging and the social environments that we live in, and on community. We've added questions over time. We did a factor analysis. We came up with these 4 clusters in the factor analysis, which means we're essentially measuring 4 different things. And the first one is feeling socially and emotionally supported and hopeful. But that's an internal feeling about one's experience of life. And the literature is very clear on both of those, that people's mental health and physical health tends to be better when they have higher rates of those things, and their productivity as well. The second one, having 2 or more people who give concrete help when needed, comes from 2 places. It comes from the Center for the Study of Social Policy Strengthening Families framework. Mm-hmm. Many of you probably know it's one of the 5 strengthening families. Lots of research behind that framework. And it also comes from the Long Scan study. So the Long Scan study is a child welfare study. Washington was one of the states, longitudinal study of many, many families engaged with the child welfare system at one point in the study. And what they found is really stunning, that for every additional person, adult, that LOM could count on for practical help, it had benefit in the child well-being score equal to that family earning another $15,000 a year. If that family had been higher income, the child well-being score would reliably go up. That's also true for additional people. So, of course, we want our families to have better incomes. In this economy, it may not be possible to move that needle very rapidly. And so we were interested in this question because if it can raise child well-being scores, even in the face of poverty, we care about that. We wanted to know about it. The community reciprocity is a cluster of questions, and it's about how we interact with one another in neighborhoods or housing units or whatever, people that we're in proximity with. And it's about whether we're looking out for children, intervening, whether we do favors for each other. And that one comes from the Chicago Neighborhood Study. So Dr. Suzette Fromm-Reed did analysis of the Chicago Neighborhoods data, which is gigantic. And she found that even in the most impoverished, highest risk neighborhoods, when these three factors were high, child abuse was lower. So we thought, that's promising for reducing ACE scores. So we pulled it from that body of evidence. And then finally, the question on social bridging is about, if you imagine the circle of people you would normally relate to and rely on in your life, how common is it for one of those people to reach outside to someone you don't know well and bring help in, for someone inside your circle of friends, colleagues? That social bridging is growing in the literature as a real focus on social capital. It's seen as more difficult to build, but especially important in places, in my opinion, where you have really high ACE scores, because everyone in the social circle is probably struggling, right? There isn't necessarily in the circle of people a lot of extra resource to help each other. Social bridging allows you in a whole county to weave strengths across those social groups and bring those strengths to bear on helping families and children and neighborhoods. Social bridging, the question itself comes from the field of anthropology, where they've studied for 100 years the strength of societies, especially when they're recovering from some kind of major assault, whether that's an environmental one or a social one. And social bridging is a critical factor to build. So that's where we got these. And in your booklets, you see some maps, and I'm not going to talk a lot about the maps, but we're beginning to be able to, in addition to mapping ACE scores, we're also beginning to be able to map places where we see high and low levels of these positive factors. In Clark County, this is an example I put it in. We have the same region where you have very, very high ACE scores with high percentage of people with six or more ACEs also feeling a lack of social emotional support and hope in their lives. And it's a good illustration of something I want to have us all be aware of, because I don't want to overstate what this data says. It's probably a bi-directional effect, right? People who have a lot of ACEs may find it more difficult to feel socially, emotionally supported. And when they do, it's helpful for their health. So we probably have this bi-directional, and it may be harder to build the social emotional support in a neighborhood where you have such a high ACE scores. I think it's possible. But we're going to have to pay more attention, especially to emotional safety as we do it. So I'm not going to go through all of these. I have charts and graphs that you'll see. But I just want to show you the power behind some of these positive factors. This is activity limitations due to some kind of poor health. And this is people with low support and hope. And you see this dose-response relationship. ACE scores along the bottom, and the percentage of population with activity limits up the vertical axis. But watch how much lower the percentage of the population is when they have high levels of social emotional support and hope. This big drop, We think that drop is too large to be attributable only to this difference in our ability to feel social and emotional support. This drop is too big, according to the national epidemiologist that we've checked with. We think it's also that this factor is powerful in helping people.
So Laura, how fine can we get the data? So for example, when we look at that area, can we tune down to census block or other areas to try to start looking at neighborhoods?
We can't get to city block because the sample size isn't big enough. We have had, quite frankly, a lot of resistance at Department of Health in adding these questions for multiple years. So the way you get a bigger sample size is you add questions for 3 or 4 years in a row. Social emotional support is in the core every other year, so you probably can get to enough years to get to block size. But
the problem with adding the years, though, is then you can't do trends.
You can't do trends.
You're looking at a bunch of years together.
Right. So we are currently funded to write a feasibility report on what would it take to really get to the level we need in our state, and can we get private and public funders together? Because folks are beginning to understand why we would care.
But you know, what we were talking about earlier during the break is that there's a lot bigger sample size in the Healthy Youth Survey.
Right.
I mean, what questions we can add to a Healthy Youth Survey to get at some of this stuff.
And we're starting to combine do geographic analysis with both Purpose and Healthy Youth Survey, so you'll see those coming soon. So when you just look at the shape here, the orange bars compared to the green bars, this is smoking.
Laura, would you be willing to share your slides with us?
Yes.
I'm interested in that, as well as with graph.
Yeah, absolutely. So mental health, look at these big differences in poor mental health, more than half of the last month. When we look at mental health symptoms, we see these big differences as well. Poor health, ability to work. We can imagine building different partners when we have this information about pretty simple things that you can change that have that are correlated with big differences in the prevalence. This is two or more people in a house. You see the same patterns. This is hunger because they didn't have enough money, which is logical. If you got people that will show up and help you, you're less likely to be hungry because of money. That makes sense. But maybe this is less obvious, diabetes or depression, mental illness symptoms using the Kessler scale, poor health. And then we're just starting to do the analysis on these community resilience, and it's promising. We see our preliminary analysis is better rates of these things, obesity, mental illness symptoms, alcohol consumption among women, physical activity, happiness, worry, having a primary care physician. Interestingly enough, the list of things that we see correlated with social emotional support and having people that will help me tends to be more health status. This list has more health behaviors mixed in. So we think we're going to see in the analysis that when you have both, when you have high rates of all four, we see behavior and health status improve. That's where we think you're just going to see the build gain, is when we're moving all four of those and improving. So in closing, I want to say that I think we really are in a new era of prevention and public health. We're really understanding that we have to affect the whole person, their life course, how their journey of their life is affected, and the context. We understand time, both in terms of risk and in terms of which supports are relevant at what time of life, and the literature is starting to get stronger in that area. We need to invest in positive adaptation, like we biologically adapt to what are the accommodations, and how do we build more positive adaptation across the life course. Dual generation strategies, and then you know, we're more aware that we have to shift this interplay between stress and the kinds of supports and healing environments that people have. This is all really new. So one of the most common things for professionals to be saying to clients is, I'm sorry you experienced such difficulty. How have you done so well? Or, we didn't know back then. We know more now. So how would you like to use this information in your own family? Simple scripts that aren't about blame. They're just about, we've learned some things, and now we're standing in a new era. Any questions? I don't think there are any. If you're on board. So, we're gonna do an interactive process to explore some action ideas. And they can be action ideas that are about the committee, but you may have action ideas that all during this presentation you're thinking, we could change this and it would matter. So I want to just give you a couple of minutes to think for a second about, are there some actions that this science would suggest we consider? For the committee or for your work, and then I'm going to have you come and stand around here, and we'll probably have a size of the group where we can consider about five, maybe six. And what'll happen is we'll stand around, five or six of you will come, you'll put your idea on a piece of paper, that will become a discussion group. The rest of us will become consultants to you as a host for your idea. And we'll move from table to table, we'll answer three or four questions, and we'll flesh out those ideas together to consider, what if we took this action? How would that unfold? What would that look like? So some of us will be consultants, and others of us will be hosts. So just think for a couple minutes, and then come up, about 2 minutes, come up and stand and circle around these papers. You're just thinking if anything has sparked your mind about an action idea that you might want to host. Not everyone maybe wants to, but some people might think of an idea, an action you'd want to consider, and have other people helping you think that through.
What are the kids really? Conversations going in any one moment. So, whoever would like, whoever has an idea, you can
You could be, you could be pushed into the center.
Okay. Right. So I just write it down?
Yeah, just write it down. Write it down, and then once it's written, say what it is, so we know what.
Secret.
I don't think if you're wearing a uniform and you have a secret table, it's kind of scary.
Exactly.
Same.
He's going to make us sit at his
Participating.
What I want to do, I want to do law enforcement training on ACEs and LS and brain development. So when we go out, our officers go out and make contact with these kids, you know, and I'll be the first to admit when I was a young cop, you sit and yell at them and say, why are you doing stupid things? But now you know, hey, now you know why they're doing stupid things. So I think it'd be better for us, better response, better relationships. And also when we go in these homes, we can look for things and add in the report. So prosecutor, probation, have a better idea of what that family dynamics are. That's my idea.
So our table really thought it was important that more people learn about ACEs, that we get the word out, that we educate, especially young adults, so that they can do the best job possible with their own children and not keep the intergenerational going. So how do we go about getting the word out?
Especially with young people.
Well, I think our group, well, I have, and I've talked with several people, that get more specific data to neighborhoods before we come up with, we can come up with some grand plan of what we think needs to be done, but we really need to target it. This neighborhood might have a different need than this neighborhood. And so we really try to cross-reference some of our databases or create new data points so that in our actions to be very, including our size match.
Create local ACEs training resources, and it sort of dovetails on you and him. I put it right, because you guys kept saying it.
Local training resources.
Local.
Two more. Other action?
Can you comment on things that you've already said? For example, what you just said. How would you look at money to full speed incorporate new clubs, religious activities, provide, say, bridging support, or what sort of activities do you do?
Everything that is already out there, like share house and the shelters and all of those support spots that are there.
So, any whole other topics?
One thing that came up in our table, and we put it on as a topic, but the way we organize our our electronic health records, and when we encounter folks in EDs or hospitals or clinics and all that, it's oriented towards the individuals and being able to create family electronic health records and mm-hmm. the association between, like even in the mental health area. So if an adult is seen for a mental health issue, we could tie the data, somehow the record back, make it more of a family, some sort of being able to look at people in the context of their families or their living environment.
Right, but that was a great discussion.
Pretty genius.
We hosted a think tank last week before the two-day conference, and we also hosted our host. And we brought amazing researchers and practitioners in from across the country. And one of the people is Colleen Kraft. She's not done exactly that, but she built a model in Virginia where she integrated medical home visiting, community health worker, social network building, and dual generation medical. And she's Billy Metcalf. She's funding the whole thing. So it's possible. Anyone last topic?
I have been thinking about an innovation.
Uh-huh.
Where it's an action where you will be able to target people who already have this problem and see what we can do to improve it.
Yeah.
And use your own
resources.
Yeah.
I like that. So let's have that be the sixth conversation. So it's really working with people, parents or adults that already have been affected by ACEs, and do some systematic learning about what really helps. That's a good interpretation of the
question.
Good.
But Jess mentioned working with our collaboratives that are already functioning well. And as I was listening, I thought, it would be great if we could create these work groups in those collaboratives to look at where the intersections are in their work to help them bring these filters to what they're doing.
I just thought of something else also based on what you were saying earlier. If we could even do a pilot for some of our service delivery programs where we don't require appointments and we can do the walk-ins, even try to do that in some aspects of the community. I haven't written about this. I think we ran out of paper, but we, it seems like, based on what you were saying earlier, we expect people to follow the rules and the procedures that we have in place. So even if we could do it on a speed line behind you,
I do.
Why don't you leave that table?
We'll
give you open space for someone. So we can do it on a small scale to see how it works with a, population.
See,
it's
a paper problem.
get rid of the
but we need a host.
Go ahead and write it out and be on those.
Well,
even for like a
health. Are you willing to integrate into your, because local training resources could link to making sure that the collaborators are
and we could link our two because we're talking more this and that, sort of a bigger picture.
Yeah, I think we can have 7 tables going. So what I'm going to just give you 5 minutes to get something, get it played, but I'm also going to try to put big pieces of paper on these tables because what I'd like you to do is have at least one person at the table who's taking notes. Others can draw or whatever you want to do, but we'd like to be able to capture notes and give you back a report from your own thinking about what if you did pursue these kinds of actions, what do you think? And so what we're going to do is you're going to get something to eat, and then the first round of conversation is going to be about this. What is the quest? What is the deep desire for what will happen? What's the why? What are you really hoping will happen because you took this action?
So are we going to have one person probably to each table and the rest of us?
Just evenly distribute to the table, and you'll be...
Are we going from table to table if we're not hosting as an hour?
Yes. And you'll stay at one table for this question, then I'm going to introduce a second question, and you'll go to the second table.
Oh, you mean all of them?
You mean that this one might need to be the same one with 7 of them.
Yeah.
People are doing their own thing over here and their own thing over here.
I've got a plan for you.
One more SRO involved.
Okay.
I don't know if it's bad or not, but I asked for another SRO and a grant. So I want to put a grant in the K-3 grade.
Where's the SRO?
It's not, well, he's at the high school, but it is all the schools and backgrounds. But I'd like to have one this K-8 grade and then the high school guy gets to stay in high school.
Do we have 2 high school though?
Well, you guys do. Not with Steve Boundary. You've got Brett Prairie.
Oh, Prairie's not in the world.
Yeah, you're not
what
the
is
city.
The law enforcement? We have 2 different law enforcement entities serving the district.
Yeah.
Sadly. Isn't City of Vancouver the other one?
Well, for us, the Vancouver School District is only in the county.
It's the county.
Well, Vancouver School District has
that works.
Is our zero. And then Brett Prairie.
It was much more work. You come from that. No, that I do that for kind of work. We really need to do this and figure it out because we have to figure it out. All right, get that done.
Do you need any help with that stuff there?
I don't think so. I think so.
Doing okay?
So, no, this will be a post, and then a group of people with that post. And that group will talk about this kind of question.
Oh,
for about 15
minutes. What is the question? What's the desire about what will happen because you took this? About 15 minutes.
The name that you just mentioned.
Yes, Colleen. Yes.
And she got recruited by Cincinnati Children's Hospital.
Okay. She's now at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. She did this in Virginia, but she moved to Cincinnati Children's Hospital in the spring to make it there. So yeah, email me. And there's no wrong answer. Just explore where the conversation takes you. What are you hoping will happen because you took this action?
For me, what I want is to work with the world.
Hey Catherine, this is Julie. This is wonderful. I just wanted to check.
This table doesn't have a host. What happened to this?
Yeah, five pickup.
Oh, it's because you combined. Okay, got it.
So, you know, maybe you can get a potential or so. Call me. What?
Hey, Julie, I'll give you this one, and I'll take care of it, okay?
Why?
Oh, where are you? Behind.
Oh, you're just... Oh, I see what you mean. There you go.
Thank you.
Thank you.
partnerships and all these other things.
That it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
In about
how long years?
30.
I thought ears were pretty tight.
They are tight.
Uptight.
Mm. Oh, that's a good picture. My daughter plays volleyball.
Is this her?
Yeah.
Well, do you have a front picture of her?
Here. Let's do this one. How's that going to be one? I'll show you a picture. Yeah, how can I ever be mad at you? Okay, hold on.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to wrap up these conversations.
Is that one of your
questions? I'm going to give you some instructions.
Here, look. That's the kind of side.
So the hosts are going to stay at your table.
Yeah. It looks like you.
No,
and hosts, your job is going to be just like if somebody arrives late and you're having a party in your house and you're very politely say, here's what we're talking about. Just really a quick snapshot to bring people into the conversation at the table. So it doesn't need to be a whole review of everything that was just talked about, just more like a here's what the conversation is so you can enter in. So a host is going to stay at the table with that role and the role of facilitating the next discussion. Everybody else is going to stand up and move to a different table and sit down. So we're mixing all up. And we're going to have about 15 minutes on this question. What's radically right that we're building on?
We're taking notes on that.
And I have more pieces of paper for people that need more paper.
That's it.
We met at John's party.
Yeah.
What happened to the food?
Julie gave it away.
She came back to see if we took it all, and we didn't exactly, so I actually took all of us what we had made and took it. Made some brownie points. Nice. Oh, she left a couple of weeks now, so did everybody get those? Yeah, I was just curious.
Where the teachers and faculty have been trained. So we're here to basically talk about what's going on now in this area.
You?
This is a good part of the day for you when you can finally sit down.
Is she ready to get a little?
You want me to get some?
Yeah, you can take it there.
Yes, I can. I tried to talk to that for you.
I know.
All right.
But I want to hear it.
No, I'm done. I'm kind of like that. Boy, that was
okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Tell them you're getting it for someone is, you know. With what we're building on, with
gravity,
right? For example,
Why do we have to
always a football player who doesn't beat his
yeah.
Only the branch on your head. So, and that would be true in juvenile, and maybe the judges. I don't know if it's going on now, if they're doing any training. We don't have to end this society.
But I think that we're going to more and more of this.
By providing like the opportunity to get together.
That's what I was doing right now. We could do it, but it's a lot. I think I'd love to see it.
Yeah, they have to do
that. I'd love to see it.
Yeah. Or,
maybe there could also be something in the HR that basically alerts providers to think about stuff when they're seeing kids with different, I don't know, but, you know, pop-ups notifications or updates, I don't know. But think about it, at least, when you're seeing kids. Well, there should be screens for it, but basically they see a kid.
Well, my daughter sent me the cutest video.
Oh, I gotta see it.
So this is Lola and Clyde, and they're washing their cars.
Oh, look at them.
Oh, shoot. I hit the button.
I really need to wash my car, Whitey, she said.
Oh, and then he just left her.
He first told her no, then she sort of begged him. So those are those little Lightning McQueen, and he's got favor from cars that whole week.
There's a now, I mean, people who work in restaurants are getting close to them.
Are
you going to get later, please?
No. Is he two? Yeah. No?
No.
No is the main word. I love two-year-olds. They're my favorite.
Yeah. Wait, it's so funny to me. They're like, she, my daughter, let him watch Mary Poppins of all things. And they're just totally into it. So she wants to be Mary Poppins, and he wants to be Bruce, you know, the character that what's his name played, Dick Van Dyke played. Yeah. And here he walked right up to me and told me, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. The whole word.
Wow, that's true.
I know, but kids are just exposed to so much more than we ever were as kids.
You know, my grandson's six now, and he is so impatient with me because I don't know all the characters in all the movies.
Yeah.
He's like,
what's he into?
Man, why don't you know? He loves superhero movies, but his little sister loves princesses, and he knows everyone from all that whole range.
Yeah. Lola's totally into princesses. Had to, for the longest time, she would not wear regular clothes. She had to wear a princess dress everywhere she went. Yeah. Funny.
So great.
It's pretty funny. Totally different than I remember my kids. I mean, they all get hooked on whatever the
theme is.
Yeah. I had a laugh because a friend of mine was heading down to California, and she was going to her first birthday party. Well, the theme of the party is Star Wars, and it's only because her daddy was into Star Wars when he was you know, and at one, who cares? You know, but no, but it will by two or three.
She's gonna care.
That was funny. You see your grandkids a lot? They live by you?
Yeah, they live nearby, and I see them. I see them every week, but I see them most weeks.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, but I have one that's all the way in New York, and I only see them like two or three times a year.
Where?
New York.
Oh.
Too far?
Do you travel back, what did you say, a couple times a year? A
couple times a year.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I wish I was closer.
So it's got to be one that way.
Yeah.
My son just lives up the gorge, but my daughter lives at, not far from here, probably, Sumner.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a little way.
But it's only 2 hour drive.
Yeah.
So we see them a lot.
You can't drop by.
Not quite yet.
No. A little too far for that.
Yeah. Well, I bet you'll be glad to be done with Clark County for a while.
I'm excited with what's happening.
Yeah. Yeah. I looked at your map and I was sort of surprised at the area that shows the higher aces. I would have thought it would have been Yakult. I mean,
yeah.
Just because.
That's what I was surprised at, that it wasn't Yakult.
Yeah.
That is precisely what I was surprised at when I looked at the map. And then when they were saying, well, these are all the poor places, I'm like, really? You don't have poverty here? And they were like, oh, yeah, we do. Huh. But
it always makes me wonder, though, if the data that you collect, too, if people are being honest when they actually...
Well, it's such a huge sample. It's 36,000.
So, yeah.
So I think that does not seem
it that. Should be statistically correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it is a little bit skewed by who has a phone.
Oh,
and Yakult's got some areas that, well, I think they all have quite a phones. I don't know. It could be, you know, like we see pockets of eastern Washington where people are like, oh, for sure that's really bad, and it's not bad at all. And the immigrants from parts of Mexico and Latin America, they honor childhood. Their ACEs are not as high. So even though they're poor and they're immigrants and they're...
That doesn't mean that they're abusive or they're...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. So if you were to measure other stress, it might be high, but this particular set of tests...
Well, you have a really large community of, like in Amboy, Yakult, and Hawkinson of... Russian and apostolic Lutheran families, and so maybe to some degree that actually is also like maybe they do also
somewhat protective in some way.
Yeah.
I know those the Russian immigrants are tend to be more domestic violence, but that doesn't necessarily mean there would be 10. It could be one or two, but they're serious ones. Interesting.
Well, I do know that the apostolic Lutheran community, they're very tight-knit. They're like big in a family.
Uh-huh.
You know, they don't drink, or supposedly don't drink. You know.
And it could be that there's more support.
Yeah.
Because of that tight-knit.
Yeah. And they don't, I mean, they don't watch television. So... Maybe my characterization of that area is wrong.
Isn't it? Yeah, it could be.
Yeah.
Well, that's really cool.
Interesting.
Because we can.
Yeah, I live in Mason County, and we have the highest AIDS prevalence among adults in the state.
Really?
Yeah. In the shelf in the southern end of the county, it's 22% of adults have 6 or more AIDS. It's 1 out of 5. And I served as an elected official there, so I really do understand.
We're not really a table. I mean,
no, you're supposed to stay at the table.
Wait, but
I'm going to...
have you move pretty soon.
Okay. 4 minutes.
4 more minutes at this table, then I'm going to ask a new question.
How come they're not moving?
She
I wasn't really included in this.
She is.
Well, we were talking about it.
We were talking about the maps.
Yeah, we were talking about the maps.
She was surprised that the Yakult had such a high eight is not as high.
Well, I think the problem is getting down to small numbers. And it's that was small. This is Berkeley's data, right?
It's Berkeley's, yeah.
There probably aren't, you know, there's 700 data points each year. In Clark County, and over 3 years, it's 2,100 data points. And when you think about, so I don't know what the confidence intervals are, but I bet you they're pretty wide.
We didn't report on anything that was under 50.
So, yeah, right, but for confidentiality reasons, yeah. But not for statistical reasons. 50 is a small number.
It really is.
So the issue is you get into a small, when you, and especially when you do multiple comparisons, there's something called Bonferroni adjustment that I'm sure you know about. But once you get down into small numbers, this is a great tool. I'm definitely in favor of it, but you can't really say that Yakult is necessarily different because you have a small numbers problem. I haven't looked at the raw data, but
so basically, just because the population isn't as dense.
When you have a small number of surveys, which is what BARFIS is. The rates can change significantly from year to year, not because there's anything different about the population, but the sample that you have is so small, it's not representative. It's just, like if you have 10...
The best we could do that by having 3 years, but it still is a small... I mean, statewide it's 36,000.
You know the
but
chance of getting...
Little school district, yeah.
You know the chance of flipping a coin, it's going to be 50-50, whether it's heads or tails. And if you flip a coin a million times, you'll get 500,000, about 500,000 heads.
Each.
If you flip a coin 10 times, you might get 8 heads and 2 tails. That's, and then if you do it another time, you may get the opposite. So it's the same coin, but I'm sorry, I'm putting my academic hat on.
But it's also possible that the particular immigrant groups that are in that part of the county have an agricultural norm around these particular familial patterns.
It's possible.
I mean, I think the immigrants from Ukraine and Russia, we see big domestic violence problems on a population level, but maybe not so much some of the other races.
You're saying there are big domestic violence problems in the Ukraine and Russian populations?
That's what I understand.
Actually, I'm having trouble with them in terms of treating their kids for TV, but that's another long conversation.
It's a big issue with pressing any authorities.
Yeah.
Understandably.
Well, yeah, I've been to that part of the world. It's really kind of interesting. I've been to the Caucasus, Ukraine. You've been to the Caucasus?
No, but I've been to Siberia and across the Mongolian border. Okay.
I've been to Georgia, wow. Azerbaijan, and the Caucasus, and then I've been to Kiev in Ukraine. You been there?
No, I'd love to go there.
And Moscow. So, interesting.
The
interesting
thing that
places.
I was the most shocked
you could see,
with the Siberian women was they had never had a conversation about any issue they cared about. It wasn't safe to do that. And they were like, and they were here learning about democracy, and they went there. And they were like, really? You talk about issues? Because you couldn't trust them.
You know, I was talking to a former health district employee that works for CMAR now, and she's Russian born. And she was telling me something really interesting the other day. She said that as soon as her and her husband got over here, her aunts and uncles started writing them for money.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, routinely. Because their belief system is it's just coming out our ears.
Yeah.
But when you go there, you realize how poor people are and how much corruption there is.
She was saying that, they wanted her to spend $3,000 for somebody's funeral.
So in Azerbaijan, the doctors make about $25 a month, and the nurses make about $15. And the only way they survive is people pay them under the table. I mean, there's corruption. People are really hurting for money.
I just needed a mix. I'm moving on, so.
Oh, okay.
Pleasure to dawdle with you.
Yeah.
And your host, once again, is going to quickly fill people in to join your table and then have a discussion about.
Thank you.
What is needed or next?
Well, you can see it one more time.
What is needed or next?
And with money.
So everybody that's not at home, stand up and move to a new table that you haven't been to yet.
I keep eating, Julie. Like, I'm going to be visiting Omar the Tent Maker. My closet.
Yeah, well, me too.
You are the greatest.
No.
Try to distribute yourself fairly evenly.
I had an email from him a while back, and then just a little quick one on Facebook. That he thought that he did his triathlon.
No.
Well, it wasn't one of those. It was sort of a sprint.
It was a mini. Yeah. I did one too. No, I was up at the.
Okay.
We just had a conference last week, and the governor came.
Yeah, he introduced.
Super funny. Did you hear about that?
No.
Well, we need to stretch it out because the governor wasn't there yet. Oh my God, it was so funny. It's happened for the 300 people. He's like, I'm getting the stretch sign. I guess I got to stretch this out. Oh, he was hysterical.
Well, what did
he say? Oh, he started making stuff. I don't know. He's like, I really wish we had the slides for that. I wish you all had. It's so funny. People are howling. Oh, it was so funny. It was adorable. And a lot of people there, not a lot, but a number of them know him. So that made it even, for me, it was very funny because talk about out of your comfort zone, right? And somebody said, you could dance. And John's like, I mean, it was funny. But then this was
he
really
didn't
sweet.
Take off his jacket to show his tattoo or anything like that.
No. But then, so then, and he's just the biggest deal. Like, I was kind of prepared for how big of a deal he is.
Really?
So that was kind of fun because then the governor came in, and then later in the day, he'd been on scandals and all these, I mean, it's all healthy, so they all want to meet his time, right? They're like, so he starts to the back of the room, and I'm sitting there eating my lunch. And I'll be damned if he doesn't come walking all the way across the room, ignoring people, to say,
that must have been pretty cool.
He's like, I have not hugged you yet. I'm like, oh my God, you're a rock star. What are you doing talking to me?
I was fine when he came down here and they had a Board of Health meeting here. At the Heath. Then I went to that and I got, did a lunch with him and all that stuff.
Yeah, he's a big deal.
Yeah, but what I think that you're married to that would be kind of, she just had sort of like a way about her that didn't probably inspire a lot of people.
Right.
Plus, he just has so many, I mean, it's not that she didn't have the contact, but he just has a performance no matter what. He's just always there.
He's a really good, he's a very good leader. And the more he gets higher up, he gets the more people that he is influencing, the better his skills become. And that's not everyone's talents, but it's his.
Yeah, and not only that, he has the energy for it. He's a little person who sits up at 4 in the morning, and, you know, and he'll have something he has to have prepared, and he's the best time. He would need to do a presentation, and we get up at 4 in the morning and do it then. Even though, I mean, he's like, what do you worry your head off and be working on? All night, working on it all night. Not him. He'd wait till 4 in the morning and it would be perfect.
Well, because he's, you know, that book that Malcolm Gladwell's book, he did this thing where he said, to be an expert in something, you need 10,000 hours. And like he took these examples of Beatles, or how do these people become amazing? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He said 10,000 hours. And one of the things they're able to do is whatever it is. They just do that. 10,000 hours of that, and you're an expert. Basket weaving, singing like the Beatles, and John has been doing what he's doing. So he's not up all night because he knows, probably, at 4 in the morning when he gets up, exactly what he's supposed to say.
Yeah, he pretty much has it in his head.
Right, 10,000 hours, yeah. He's got it in there.
And even if he didn't write down a darn thing, he could get up and
do it.
And
yeah.
And it.
See, that's what you're. That's why.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And I almost, most of the time, I almost knew what he was going to say before he said it.
Where?
Because after you start writing it, typing it, reading it, being around him and seeing it, you start to get it by osmosis.
The 10,000 hour thing. That's pretty incredible when people get to a level of knowledge and expertise there
because they really can't.
Just think how much 10,000 hours.
Do you know Malcolm's stuff?
Yeah, I love it.
You're kind of like, what you're saying is so ingrained in your, I imagine you've been doing it for a number of years.
It flows out so evenly, and I'm still trying to like do it.
When you're shifted to a new paradigm, which I think we have, but then it takes society that much practice before like they can think with this in the way.
Right. This is very interesting that way to me, because there's a certain segment of the population that operates under the belief that you're just a bad person.
Yeah. Totally.
You do bad things, you're a bad person.
You're a bad person.
And we need
you've made a bad choice.
Right. And if we just punish you, then you do it again.
Yes. And if we threaten to punish you, it might even worse.
You know what? Here's something that just came to my attention that it's just unconscionable. Like a visceral reaction. I don't do it that often. So we're all about this incarceration of young men of color that are in your. Our jails are basically making money by putting men of color in them and blah, 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 blah.
Right.
So one of my colleagues is out, and she's working closely with the sheriff, and he comes to her and he says, and she's been teaching stuff for about 5 years, this, you know, and this is a very Republican part of our state.
Yeah.
Because he goes, I got to tell you something. It's just so confusing. We just don't think this is right. She goes, tell me what's going on. Well, the e-cigarette people, apparently are going to the sheriff. He's getting bombarded like email after email. When you are running your jail, you can make a small fortune off of selling e-cigarettes to inmates. And just think about, they said to him he can make $50,000 a year to taking this new product. And they even say, oh my gosh, they're going to be so well much more controlled. Okay, so just take
also the jails are our main mental health.
Oh, so they have, there's a rationale behind it.
Oh my gosh.
Good, there's benefit to them.
I hope I'm not going to offend anyone. But the jump from, so like jail cell, shit full of slaves.
Yeah.
Product that's addictive?
Yeah.
Product that's addictive.
Totally.
We'll sell this to you. And let's also just put them on farms where, what was that called? They're sharecroppers. I was just like, oh my God. And the only reason, it's unconscionable. The only reason the sheriff talked to her was, and he was truly saying, you know, Deb, I'm just going to come to you and ask this question because I just don't think this is right. We should not be making.
God, for him having that internal.
And she said, she actually sent me the link that he sent her that said, I'm like, yes. And they're talking about the profitability
of
e-cigarettes being sold in jail systems, the profitability for them. She was like, they stand to make a small fortune. $50,000 a year to them is tons of money that they wouldn't otherwise be making.
Who is it?
You want me to send you the email?
I want the link.
How do inmates have money?
Well, apparently, in our non-slave system, I think that they can earn money while working in there.
They can work for a dollar an hour. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let's just take that dollar back because we've now caused an addiction that is serious.
Yeah.
And it's medically withdrawing, right?
And there's no, I just learned recently, there's not any controls at all on the ingredients in e-cigarettes.
No, so that's part of the strategy is that you can have that doses of nicotine. If they weren't addicted when they came in, you can have it be.
Yeah.
It's science. You can, I think, you can jack it up so that they're jonesing every. And then spending all the money that they're. Let's just put earning in quotes here because they're not really, right? It's visceral. Visceral. I was like, I am so incensed by this.
Somebody
I'm not sure I can.
Sue them. Somebody needs to take that to court.
Isn't that interesting? Really, I was just like.
Because the combination of minority people and people with mental illness, that's where they are.
Which we're all about, too. That she does a lot of training on the dual diagnosis. Jail e-cig, quite a marketing plan. You want me to send it to you? Here.
Yeah.
Do you know iPhones? So just go like that and forward. Now put right there, put your email in. It can happen. Seriously, I think I'm going to forward that to Paul Davis up there at the BOH to say, Paul?
Yes.
It's ridiculous.
It's so funny. It's not really funny, but, you know, I listen to this information about the ACEs and whatnot, and all of it clearly makes sense. You know, everybody can point to somebody, but it was just only the other day that I actually kind of thought, oh, my best friend.
Yeah.
It's so profoundly affected from that, from an abusive father, and not sexually abusive, but physically abusive, and a really messed up family life. And I used to say to her, why is it you miss work all the time?
Wait, look at this. The only electronic cigarette designed by a jailer specifically for use in correctional facilities. I told her, I said, that's a 60-minute undercover story. Let's just send that to Marley Schaefer. I'm already incensed that our jails anyway, need we say more?
Yeah, we have more people incarcerated in this country than probably all.
What did they say? A white man without an education is 5% more likely to be hired. No, a white man with a felony conviction and jail time is 5% more likely to be hired than a black man
with no,
but I think an education. I mean, it's ridiculous.
It's crazy.
You know, a particular relevance to me is I have a lifelong friend who didn't tell me till she was in her 20s and her first daughter was born about the ongoing prolific sexual abuse by her birth father, which has been quite a traumatizing event in itself, but started at 9 and 10.
9 and 10?
And then you just go like
girls
this.
Are so vulnerable.
Okay, so that's the application to why she... We all graduated from college, and she dropped out. What she had trouble with.
Yeah. You start seeing these patterns. Yeah.
Well, my friend, who like,
and this whole thing of girls can't do math very well in middle school.
Right.
Constantly calling in.
Because she actually feels sick all the time.
Well, but then I also realized that she was drinking all the time.
Right. My friend has a serious alcohol problem.
I mean, so all of those things start going hand in hand, and not only that, but then I found out that her father. No, he was raised in an orphanage and was beaten.
Yeah, the intergenerational thing is really...
On and on.
But, you know, with those kind of stories...
Is it because they're prepubescent? I don't understand that.
They don't understand why, but it's very clear that the brain change is most significant among girls who experienced it during that time. So Marty's research is he finds, you know, hundreds of people who experienced only one kind of maltreatment, and he does brain scans, and he knows what age they were, and he verifies it through child welfare, police, etc. So it's all verified.
Right. I'm sure he's great at that.
And the change in the brain is most significant when the girls experience sexual abuse at that age.
And
so it's it's when that part of the region is in its growth and development and most effective.
Yeah, I'm sure she was 10 years old. Sure of it. And then, this is awful too, went to her middle school teacher the next year and told her what was happening. And do you know what she said? Go home and tell your mom. I'm sure it's nothing, dear. It was the one adult she talked to. And when she told me that when I was like 24, I'm like, let's call the building and see if she's still employed.
Yeah, really. Really.
Have a little chat about mandatory reporting.
I'm assuming that most of the teachers, most of them are given really good instruction.
Okay, we're going to go to 2 minutes.
That's one thing you can talk to people about. Oh,
some of us get a little 5-minute break.
You're
going to
have a very, very high rate of correct response. We're going to want to hear like 99.8. There's not a single teacher walking around that doesn't know. They may not know specifics, but they certainly know they should. Right? Gets me so mad about that tobacco thing.
They were talking about that at the Board of Health meeting. Although I did think that Don actually had a good question. He just wanted to know what the data was about, you know, whether how bad they are for you and blah, 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 before they start, you know, advocating. Yeah,
oh, no, there's a fair body of research that says they should stop smoking too as well. And I had a sister-in-law heavily addicted. And when she got her e-cigarettes, she could control the dosage, and she titrated herself down. It's a very good, if people use it correctly, it's a nice harm reduction model.
You could, you know what I mean, you could start with however many milligrams of nicotine, and then she cut herself way, way down.
Did she put it all together?
No, but she, but she's a lot less, she's a lot, using a lot less.
And she's not actually paying all of the time.
Right. And that's the other side of that story, which is it totally eliminates the carcinogen. I mean, people get lung cancer, I think, because of the But then we're just left with this notion that it's a highly addictive substance that they're marketing heavily to our youth just to get them addicted.
But you know, then they have all of these things out there now. But they only do have a bit long of their pipe, like the little pipe, and the puff, you inhale the vapor,
right.
And they're and to me, they're just no. They tend to be kind of really smelling.
Red thing's great, or the watermelon, all flavors.
It almost smells like something like maybe. I mean, that's not what it is.
You know, my 24-year-old smells like
Oh, our doors should be locked right now.
And depression. Girls who are her age group when she started have experienced depression episodes are highly likely to start smoking, and then they keep smoking because they feel like it helps mitigate the circumstance.
Yeah.
But in the long run, it actually makes the depression worse. I mean, there's all this. She's classic.
Well, I smoke too.
Well, and she, and I keep, and now she wants to quit desperately. Cause have you ever met anybody who smoked for like 3 or 4 years that doesn't want to quit?
I didn't want to quit.
Oh, you didn't?
No.
But then you did.
Yeah, but then I did. Yeah, but it was mainly my son. It was one of my son. He started following me around and saying, oh, you're going to die. So that was kind of difficult. I think it was 38.
Yeah.
So it's been a long time. But once I did quit, it was like, oh,
well, she doesn't smoke like a chimney, but she, when she drinks, she smokes. And when she's with, I mean, it's clearly
social.
Social?
Yeah. Social?
She doesn't smoke my house. Oh. Well, I'm in a room.
Did you guys ever smoke?
No.
Hmm. Good for you.
Well, my mom smoked, and I had to ride in cars with closed windows, and it made me gay.
It's my dad. And he'd do it with all seven of us in the car.
Yeah, well, he was laughing you back over the seat, looking at him, shut up.
And he smoked Camels.
I know. Camels, my grandfather smoked Camels.
Oh, yeah. His parents was dead.
Everybody's parents smoked Camels.
Yeah. My mother never smoked, ever. Oh, my dad
died of emphysema.
He did.
And when he was dying, he said, the army did this to me.
What did?
The army.
That's where my dad started, too.
Because in World War II, they gave him free cigarettes to help him deal with anxiety. Right?
My grandfather's twin sister died of emphysema. And I watched her do it. It was horrible.
Actually, almost all of my dad's aunt, uncle's, and aunts died of emphysema, but they were like 95.
That's different.
Yeah, but there's nothing worse than pushing the little oxygen thing everywhere you gotta go.
You're suffocating to death.
Yeah. But you know, they used to get up in the middle of the night and smoke. That's the thing that just got me.
Well, it's such an addictive.
How you wake up from it. Needing to.
Okay, are our hosts almost ready to report?
Okay.
Thank you. This
was very useful. Did everybody come up with some great ideas in the middle of anything?
I was trying to behave. No, me.
Yeah, you're a little disruptive.
This came up. I had a whole half hour with all three of
them. Why did you do that? Report first. Yes.
I would like to know.
I would like to know a short version of what are your hopes and what are you building on and what.
Okay, I can do that. Our hope is to train all law enforcement officers in Clark County on Ellis Green development and ACEs. Our hope is to establish better relationships with the community to look at a holistic approach to juvenile justice and also connect it with our restorative justice programs we already have in Clark County. But I think there's a gap at the front end, and obviously we need to understand why we do it, what decisions we should make at the front end, and what the benefits are, what the goal is, long-term goal, not the short-term goal of just locking somebody up. And then obviously we have issues of money. How are we going to, we're going to find the funding curriculum. It's got to be a 5-hour block or less. We don't have dates because we have other state mandates. Location, we need buy-ins from the chief and the sheriff, but we also, something we need to do in this program that we don't have is we'd love to be able to share information with different entities, and we have roadblocks with all the HIPAA and the education system has their HIPAA. You can't, it's hard to share information back and forth on the state. So that's it.
Yay!
An intervention of systematic use of establishments. So we had a great group of people coming to talk to us, and we decided that the main goal of our project was to reduce the prevalence of AIDS in our community. We decided that we were going to target social media, schools, health centers, and OB family medicine clinics. What we have was being here today, having all of these people for multidisciplinary work, and the data that you mentioned. That is something that we already have. In addition, we had Clark College, we had the neighborhood associations, we have CHARGE.
Community Health Advisory, no, I used to know the resource group. Yeah, Community Health Access Resource Group, and that meets every couple months. Support for early learning and families. There's some great organizations in place that can help with this effort, faith-based coffee.
We talk about what kind of intervention we could do. We mentioned the grand rounds at the hospitals. We already have some contacts at Legacy and Fitzhugh, so we are ready to start.
And training the residents at your
training the residents would be also a very good idea. We also talk about promotora, community health workers, who can help us with this. We need money. We also need a coalition of ACEs, and we need for all the partnership getting stakeholders to help us. We want to target the mayor's office here in Vancouver and try to organize something with them.
And educate the board.
Well, we didn't do papers for the first one, but our initial goal was to get good data to plan intervention. And we also talked about several different kinds of data. And one of the things was for us at the advisory council to actually plan or suggest any intervention. We needed to know more about what the data would tell us about the different neighborhoods and parts of our community where we focus our intervention. And then we also talked about the idea, again, it's not something that we can fix, but wouldn't it be great if the electronic health records used by healthcare organizations could be family focused? And then we translated that idea of a family focused health record to, I don't know the name of, a family focused neighborhood record, just with not including health data, but data about family. Mom, dad, mom works, dad works, two kids in school, one school. Just the information that could be perhaps housed in some kind of a virtual center so that we have some examples that if mom was taken to the hospital in an emergency room and had to be go to surgery, that the social worker would know that, from the admission form that this person lived in XYZ neighborhood, could contact the contact there because the kids they'd be worried about the kids getting home from school. So we could come up with play through lots of examples. But that was then the focus of the rest of the discussion was really on how to get that good data to plan intervention. And so we talked about the overlay of public health data, law enforcement data. We know that the sheriff's department and 911 have data that we'd like to put together.
together, education data, healthcare data, 911 data, or religious organizations, unemployment, CREC, business, and even data that we looked at in our health element chapter, and then language is spoken. And so the data, the information, we get all that data, relate it to it, and overlay it, and relate it to ACEs. And then the reason we think this is important is it can help us to identify problems, and it's an opportunity to connect the organizations to the data sources. Most importantly, we're in the world of measurement and outcomes, and so we want to have a good benchmark data for measuring improvements and outcomes. And this could help us get very localized in our neighborhoods or communities, and obviously make best use of available resources. And then what we thought was needed next was that public health would convene a work group to include, for sure, public health, the analysts from the sheriff's office, schools, 911, to begin to talk about where do we have some data that we could look at related to the data here. And then as an aside, we also talked about, you know, when we talked about the neighborhoods, we said, you know, we really need to continue to focus on building community at the neighborhood level, because that's still an issue, so we had a discussion about that. Ours is not real exciting, but I think we did it. For each organizational, for collaborative conversations, and for pilot training,
and bring that case transformation to these organizations, and then possibly even train resident experts within those organizations so that they're the case expert within their own agency. And then the collaboratives would form those work groups. The trainers would provide TA coaching to the champions and lend supply to assistance and practices. We collect data. Where are we making the difference? Based on that, we analyze it through our system and understand the improvements.
Corrections officers, and they're having really good outcomes from that.
not only for the corrections officers and police officers interacting differently with the public, but also in understanding their own patterns in their own life. Because being a corrections officer or a police officer, people with a higher A score that are much more rapidly able to act on the spot, to sense danger keenly, et cetera, it's one of the good fits. And so we find that in general in those professions, we may have people with higher A scores. And so they're like, oh, it can be a good thing if you have the right fit. So they're audiences that are most likely to understand that concept, that what we're looking at isn't to change human beings, it's to make sure that they have the right environment that fits the way they actually operate biologically in the world. So it's we've seen that in several places in the state. We've also seen law enforcement and corrections to actually collect ACE scores, but not attach them to individuals in the record, but rather take the history and notice whether officers in general are doing as well with low A score population as with high A score population. So it's a way to think about holding ourselves as professionals accountable to be just as good at working with one population as another. So we're seeing that starting to emerge in some of the law and justice, could be applicable in other parts of the service system as well. It's really different than taking an ACE history in order to make some decision about the person with the ACEs, right? You're collecting ACE histories about a group to make a decision about the professional. Are we really effective? And how do we be a learning community in order to improve our effectiveness? And you see learning community also on here in the middle section. This macro determinants arena, I didn't talk a lot about what helps people self-regulate, what helps people feel belonging, but on those lists from psychologists and sociologists and anthropologists, you will see, and neuroscientists, you will see things like rituals, music, rhythm, engaging people in regular ceremonial kinds of being together. And that can be an important way to place a key strategic change in a neighborhood. It's just to regularly host family cafes or and to support in small ways the community coming together. But coming together with a rhythmic cycle, with music, movement, drumming, those kinds of things that are anciently known as healing, right? But we tend not to include them in the way we gather in the majority culture. So that's definitely a part of what we see in the literature about helping to change norms. You can see in the courts, we're seeing emerging trauma audits. The National Association of Child and Family Justice People, judges, have developed a trauma audit where they'll send a team into your courts and look at the physical environment. And also, how do you manage transitions? Transitions can be really hard and kind of scary to somebody who's had a lot of adversity in their life. They don't know what's coming next. And so they coach judges on how you give anticipatory guidance about transition. And that same principle would apply to almost all of your projects. Like, how do we do an audit for each other about whether we're incorporating trauma-informed practice into our work? Other examples of what communities are doing in Minneapolis, they're doing these amazing community resilience coach. They used a curriculum that Rob Enda and I developed that is a train the master trainer curriculum. So we train a cohort of 25 people and they're qualified after 6 months of speaking to train others. And in Minnesota, they've started that about 2 years ago. And the folks in Minneapolis are working in the lowest income neighborhoods in the Hmong community and the African American community and the Native American community, hosting conversations about how historic trauma is affecting our intergenerational health and well-being, and recruiting people to speak out to their neighbors or going door to door and having conversations that, you know, some of the younger African-American men, for example, report never having been in a room with another African-American man. except for maybe in school. Never. He's been in the room together. So then being in a room and having a conversation about what is the age at which we really should be sharing everything about the legacy of slavery? Maybe we don't need to do that when kids are so young. And our trainers didn't bring up that subject. The neighbors brought up that subject and said, now that we understand about ACEs, we should talk about this. When do we expose our children to information that's important for them to have, but maybe not at such a young age? So amazing, like whole neighborhoods becoming learning communities together based on this idea that they named community resilience coaches. So they dual train people in both how to talk about ACEs and neuroscience and resilience, but also how to convene and how to create a safe environment for these deeper conversations to occur. Some communities, like you've probably heard the Walla Walla story, where they're doing the Community Resilience Initiative, and they've actually gathered, they started out with 50 service providers, and they all pledged to change the way they deliver services in the highest ACE neighborhoods. And at the time, we didn't could measure ACEs, so they based it on 911 call rates and out-of-home placements. Turned out to be pretty darn close to right. Pretty good indicators for where you're going to see higher ACEs. They've also trained corrections officers at the prison as well. But in these neighborhoods, service providers are constantly learning from the residents about what changes need to happen in order to be more effective in those neighborhoods. They've done everything from rebuild parks to getting the most dangerous homes torn down and reconstructed with partnership with Community Action Agency. So they've actually changed the built environment as well as the human services kinds of thing. And basically their strategy was, we're going to stay in conversation with people. In those three neighborhoods where they started, when they started, people didn't come out of their homes. So what happened was a coordinator went and sat on the hood of her car literally for weeks, every day, and just was present in their environment. And eventually people started coming out and saying, you can't be here, it's not safe. And she just said, you know, you live here, so I care about you, so I am going to be here, you're here. So I'm just here to have a conversation and figure out if there's a better way our community could be working with you so you'd be safe to come out on your front porch. Just really straight explanation for why she was there. And over the course of several years, really huge transformation in those neighborhoods. Big changes in out-of-home placement rates, injury, gang involvement, educational outcomes, etc. So that work was also integrated with changes in school, but actually the neighborhood work came first. Other examples. There are hospitals that have done ground rounds on ACEs and are changing some of the practices, although I think Dr. Ann has said to me that he thinks the docs might be the slowest to pick this up and use it, because their training really is to act once there's a diagnosis and treatment, and this isn't that kind of thing, right? If the treatment is that you listen, you ask, you listen, you acknowledge, and you remember, which is really probably the treatment at this point, then that's not as comfortable for many doctors. But we're starting to see that trend change, and we're starting to see pediatricians in our state step up and make a change in the way they do their practice. And as I said, Colleen Kraft, amazing work where she's integrated home visiting with medical home and community health workers. So we're starting to see new models emerge that are billable, which is really important. I could give you a lot more examples, but that's kind of a range. I think the important thing to keep in mind with this group, you have such breadth of expertise, is if you're willing to have a regular conversation about what actions to take next, to keep in mind that, you know, you really have this whole scope that you can work in, and sometimes a small change can make a big difference. So as we close, I wanted to talk for a couple minutes about thinking about high leverage change using the systems thinking iceberg.
So how many of you, do you know the systems thinking iceberg?
So the system sweeping iceberg was developed in the corporate sector to help multinational corporations to solve problems that were way too complex for command and control. I would submit to you that neighborhoods are way too complex to try to interact with a command and control mentality, and certainly an old county, way too complex. And the accumulation of ACEs is too, so I think it's a useful tool. The idea behind it is that it's like an iceberg. The things that we see are above the waterline. They're the events in people's lives and in the community. And we can sometimes see the patterns in those events, right? Especially people in certain positions, like many of you in this room, you start seeing patterns. But below that, the way we organize, who we communicate with, how our organizations are formed, those structures that include both the organizational structures but also our norms about who gets talked to who, structures are driving those patterns. And our mental models, our beliefs about the way the world works, are driving how we organize ourselves. And our values and principles are driving all of it. And the idea is that you get more lasting change the deeper you go below the waterline with your strategic action. So if you can double check your strategic action and say, does this action help to challenge mental models that are really old? Mental models like, people make bad choices and that's why they get kicked out. Kind of an old mental model. True of some people, but for the most part, these data would suggest that that's not really a very accurate way to think about it. An old mental model would be, people are really hard to serve because they don't show up and so they don't deserve service. That's a really good example of an old mental model. Not so useful. And there are many, right? Many mental models, because we've just taken this huge shift into a new paradigm. I also noticed in my work with the state of Washington that we don't usually talk about values. Values at the bottom of this iceberg are very, very powerful. And when we call the question with a group, if we can call that question in a way that really challenges people's values. And I would suggest that in any human group, there's always conflicting values. There's no way to avoid that. But which values we illuminate matter. And so, for example, years ago, I was part of the mental health transformation grant process, and we were having this breakout group, and folks were talking about transforming the mental health system. And I said, well, until we change the social contract, the mental health system is not going to change. And the social contract is, if you have a serious or persistent mental illness, you should live below the poverty level and be isolated and stay out of our way. That is the truth of the social contract. But we don't say it, right? We all keep that secret. But when we surface it in a way where we're like, that doesn't fit who I want to be, that's not the value I want to have, all of a sudden you get this cognitive dissonance that's really powerful driver for change. So watch for the moments where, without blaming or criticizing, you can just say, is this who we want to be? Or is there another way we want to be as the people of Clark County? That is very powerful. And when that thought process is embedded in your action plan, it's really powerful for lasting change. So I just give you that tool so that as you're thinking together about change, you can look at your strategies and say, is there a way we could drop down one more level in the iceberg? Is there a way we could embed something about mental models or values in and make sure that we're designing in these powerful strategies, ways of thinking about change? I think that's it. Look at 4:27. It's a delight to be here, and I'm excited about all the ideas. Yeah, if there are questions, then I'll stay.
It's really
And I did get the question of whether I could send slides, and I can do that so you can email them back out. Thank you.
have you kicked your husband out, too?
No.
He'll get over it.
Huh?
He'll get over it.
No.
I go down that road. I go down that road after 42 years. Let me tell you, way more often than I like to.
Okay. For me, the real driver is.